Her small apartment in Alicante was above the weapons shop on Flintlock Street that had been in her family for years. She'd closed it up when she went to live in Los Angeles with the Blackthorns. Impatience jittering her nerves, she went downstairs into the store and threw open the windows, letting in light, making the dust motes dance in the bright summer air. Her sore arm still ached, though it had nearly healed. The shop was musty inside, dust on the formerly bright blades and rich leather of sheaths and axe handles. She took down a few of her favorite weapons and put them aside for the Blackthorns. The children deserved new weapons. They'd earned them. When a knock came on the door, she successfully managed to distract herself and was sorting sword blades by the hardness of the metal. She set down one of her favorites, a weapon of Damascus steel, and went to open the door. Smirking on the doorstep was Manuel, who Diana had last seen fighting sea demons on the front lawn of the Institute. He was out of his Centaurian gear, wearing a fashionable black sweater and jeans. His hair gelled into curls. He smiled sideways at her. "Miss Rayburn," he said, "I have been sent to bring you up to the guard." Diana locked up the store and fell in beside Manuel as he made his way up Flintlock Street toward the northern part of Alicante. "What are you doing here, Manuel?" she asked. "I thought you'd be in Los Angeles." "I was offered a post at the guard," he said. "I couldn't pass up the chance for advancement. There are plenty of Centaurians still in Los Angeles guarding the Institute." He looked at Diana sideways. She said nothing. "It's a pleasure to see you in Alicante," Manuel went on. "The last time we were together, I believe, you were fleeing for London." Diana gritted her teeth. "I was taking the children who were in my charge to safety," she said. "They're all fine, by the way." "I assumed I would have heard if it had been otherwise," said Manuel airily. "I'm sorry about your friend," she said, "John Cartwright." Manuel was silent. They had reached the gate to the path leading up to the guard. Once it had closed only with a latch. Now Diana watched as Manuel passed his hand over it, and it clicked open. The path was rough, as it had been when Diana was a child, snaked with the roots of trees. "I didn't know John well," said Manuel as they began the climb. "I understand his girlfriend, Marisol, is very upset." Diana said nothing. "Some people cannot manage their grief as shadow hunters should," added Manuel. "It's a shame." "Some people do not show the empathy and tolerance a shadow hunter should," said Diana. "That's also a shame." They had reached the upper part of the path, where Alicante spread out before them like a map, and the demon towers rose to pierce the sun. Diana remembered walking this path with her sister when they were both children, and her sister's laughter. She missed her so much, sometimes it felt like her heart were being clutched by talons. "In this place," she thought, looking out over Alicante, "I was lonely. In this place I had to hide the person I knew I was." They reached the guard. It rose up above them, a mountain of gleaming stone, sturdier than ever since its rebuilding. A path lined with witch lights led to the front gate.
"Was that a jab at Zara?" Manuel looked amused. "She's very popular, you know, especially since she killed Malcolm, something the Los Angeles Institute couldn't manage."
Shocked out of her reverie, Diana could only stare at him.
"Zara didn't kill Malcolm," she said. "That is a lie."
"Is it?" Manuel said. "I'd like to see you prove that." He grinned his beaming grin and walked away, leaving Diana to stare after him, squinting her eyes in the sunlight.
"Let me see your wrist," Christina said to Mark. They were sitting side by side on the infirmary bed. His shoulder was warm against hers. He drew his sweater up and held his arm out silently. Christina folded back her bandage and put her wrist against his. They looked in silence at their identical wounds.
"I know nothing about this kind of magic," said Mark. "And we cannot go to the Clave or the Silent Brothers. They can't know we were in Faerie."
"I'm sorry about Kieran," she said. "Daddy's angry."
Mark shook his head.
"Don't be. It's my fault." He took a deep breath. "I'm sorry I was angry with you in Faerie after the revel. People are complicated. Their situations are complicated. I know why you hid Julian's feelings from me. I know you and Emma had little choice.
And I'm not angry with you now, she hastened to assure him. How about Kieran?
I am changed, said Mark, because of you. Kieran can sense that my feelings for him have altered in some way, though he doesn't know why, and I cannot tell him. He looked up at the ceiling. He is a prince. Princes are spoiled. They cannot bear to be thwarted.
He must feel so alone, said Christina.
She remembered the way she felt with Diego, that what they had once had was gone, and she couldn't understand how to get it back. It had been like trying to catch smoke that had dissolved into the air.
You are his only ally here, and he cannot understand why his connection to you feels broken.
He did swear to you, said Mark. He ducked his head, as if he were ashamed of what he was saying. It is possible that if you order him to do something, he'll have to do it.
I don't want to do that.
Christina.
No, Mark, she said firmly.
I know this binding spell affects you, too. And upsetting Kieran affects the chances he'll testify. But I won't force him into anything.
Aren't we all ready? Mark said.
Lying to him about the situation so he'll talk to the Clave. Christina's fingers crept to her injured wrist. The skin felt odd under her fingertips, hot and swollen.
And after he testifies, you'll tell him the truth, right?
Mark rose to his feet.
By the angel, yes. What do you take me for?
Someone in a difficult situation, said Christina.
As we all are. If Kieran doesn't testify, innocent downworlders may die. The Clave may sink farther into corruption. I understand the need for deception. That doesn't mean I like it, or that you do either.
Mark nodded, not looking at her.
I had better search for him, he said. If he'll agree to be helpful, here's our best way to fix this.
He indicated his wrist. Christina felt a slight ache inside. She wondered if she had hurt Mark. She hadn't meant to.
Let's see what kind of range this has, she said. How far from each other we can go without it hurting.
Mark stopped in the doorway. The clean, sharp planes of his face looked cut from glass.
It already hurt me to be away from you, he said. Perhaps that was meant to be the joke.
He was gone before Christina could answer. She got to her feet and went to the counter where the powders and medicines were. She had a rough idea of medicinal Shadowhunter work. Here were the leaves that had anti-infection properties. Here the poultices that kept swelling down. The door of the infirmary opened while she was unscrewing a jar. She looked up. It was Kieran. He looked flushed and windblown, as if he'd been outside. There were patches of color on his high cheekbones. He looked as discomfited to see her as she was to see him. She set down the jar carefully and waited.
"Where is Mark?" he said.
"He went to find you," Christina leaned against the counter. Kieran was quiet. A fairy sort of quiet, inward, considering. She had a feeling many people would feel compelled to fill that silence. She let him have it, let him draw the silence into himself, shape and decipher it.
"I should apologize," he said finally.
"It was uncalled for to accuse you and Mark of having arranged the binding spell. Foolish, too. You have nothing to gain from it. If Mark did not want to be with me, he would say so." Christina said nothing. Kieran took a step toward her, carefully, as if afraid of frightening her.
"Might I see your arm again?"
She held her arm out. He took it. She wondered if he had ever touched her deliberately before. It felt like the touch of cool water in summer. Christina felt a slight shiver up her spine as he studied her injury. She wondered what he had looked like when both of his eyes had been black. They were even more startling now than Mark's. The contrast between the dark and the shimmering silver, like ice and ash.
"The shape of a ribbon," he said. "You say you were tied together during the revel?"
"Yes," said Christina.
"By two girls. They knew we were Nephilim. They laughed at us."
Kieran's grip on her tightened. She remembered the way he'd clung to Mark in the Unseelie Court, not as if he were weak and needed help. It was the grip of strength, a grip that held Mark in place, that said, "Stay with me. It is my command." He was a prince, after all. "That sort of binding spell is one of the oldest," he said, "oldest and strongest. I do not know why someone would play such a prank on you. It is quite vicious."
"But do you know how to undo it?"
Kieran dropped Christina's hand. "I was an unwanted son of the Unseelie King. I received little schooling. Then I was thrown into the wild hunt. I'm no expert on magic."
"You're not useless," said Christina.
"You know more than you think you do." Kieran looked as if she'd startled him once again. "I could speak to my brother, Adean. I am meant to ask him about taking the throne. I could inquire of him as to whether he knows anything of binding spells or how to end them."
"When do you think you will talk to him?" asked Christina.
An image came into her mind of the way Kieran, asleep, had clung to her hand in the Seelie court. Trying not to blush, she glanced down at her bandage, tugging it back into place.
"Soon," he said. "I have tried to reach him already, but not yet with success."
"Tell me if there's anything I can do to help you," she said. His eyebrow quirked. He bent down then and lifted her hand, this time to kiss it, not seeming to mind the blood or the bandage. It was a gesture of courts long past in this world, but not in fairy. Startled, Christina did not protest.
"Lady Mendoza Rosales," he said, "thank you for your kindness."
"I'd rather you called me Christina," she said. "Honestly."
"Honestly," he echoed. "Something we fairies never say. Every word we speak is an honest word."
"I wouldn't go that far," said Christina.
"Would you?"
A thunderclap shook the Institute. At least it felt like a thunderclap. It rattled the windows and walls.
"Stay here," Kieran said. "I'll go and find out what that was."
Christina almost laughed.
"Kieran," she said, "really, you don't need to protect me."
His eyes flashed. The infirmary door flew open, and Mark was there, wide-eyed. He only grew more so when he saw Kieran and Christina standing at the counter together.
"You'd better come," he said. "You won't believe who's just portaled into the parlor."
The town of Polperro was tiny, whitewashed, and picturesque. It was nestled into a quiet harbor with miles of blue sea spreading out to where the harbor opened into the ocean. Small houses in different pale colors clambered up and down the hills that rose steeply on either side of the port. Cobblestone streets wound among shops selling pastries and soft-serve ice cream. There were no cars. The bus from Lisgard had let them off outside the town. Nearing the harbor, they crossed a small bridge at the bottom of the marina. Emma thought of her parents. Her father's gentle smile, the sun on his blonde hair. He'd loved the sea, living near the ocean, any kind of beach holiday. He would have loved a town like this, where the air smelled like seaweed and burnt sugar and sunscreen, where fishing boats traced white trails across the blue surface of the distant sea. Her mother would have loved it, too. She had always liked to lie in the sun, like a cat, and watch the ocean dance.
"What about here?" Julian said.
Emma blinked back to reality, realizing they'd been talking about finding something to eat before they passed over the bridge, and her mind had wandered. Julian was standing in front of a half-timbered house with a restaurant menu pasted up in the diamond-paned window. A group of girls passed by in shorts and bikini tops on their way to the sweet shop next door. They giggled and nudged each other when they saw Julian. Emma wondered what he looked like to them. Handsome, with all that wind-blown brown hair and luminous eyes, but surely odd as well. Little unearthly, maybe. Marked and scarred as he was.
"Sure," she said. "This is fine."
Julian was tall enough to need to duck under the low-hanging doorframe to get into the inn. Emma followed, and a few moments later they were being shown to a table by a cheerful, plump woman in a flowered dress. It was nearly 5 o'clock, and the place was mostly deserted. A sense of history hung lightly about it, from the uneven floorboards to the walls, decorated with smuggling memorabilia, old maps, and cheerful illustrations of Cornish piskies, the mischievous fair folk native to the area. Emma wondered how much the locals believed in them. Not as much as they should, she suspected. They ordered Coke and fries for Julian, sandwich and lemonade for Emma. And Julian spread his map out over the table. His phone was next to it. He flipped through the photos he'd been taking with one hand, poking at the map with the other. Smears of colored pencil decorated his hand, familiar smudges of blue and yellow and green. The east side of the harbor is called the Warren, he said. Lots of houses, and a lot of them are old, but most of them are rented out now to tourists. And none of them are on top of any caves. That leaves the area around Polperro and to the west. Their food had arrived. Emma started wolfing her sandwich. She hadn't realized how hungry she was. What's this? She asked, pointing at the map.
That's Chapel Cliff, love,
said the waitress, setting down Emma's drink. She pronounced it Chapel.
Start at the coastal path. From there, you can walk all the way to Foy.
She glanced over at the bar where two tourists had just sat down.
Oi, be right there.
How do you find the path? Julian said. If we were to walk it today, where would we start?
Well, it's a long way to Foy, said the waitress. But the path starts up behind the Blue Peter Inn,
she pointed out the window across the harbor.
There's a walking trail that goes up the hill. You turn onto the coastal path at the old net loft. It's all broken down now, but you'll see it easy. It's just above the caves.
Emma raised her eyebrows. The caves? The waitress laughed.
The old smuggler's caves, she said. I guess you came in at high tide, didn't you? Or you'd have seen them for sure.
Emma and Julian exchanged a single look before scrambling to their feet. Heedless of the waitress's startled protests, they spilled out into the street beside the inn. She'd been right, of course. The tide had come down, and the harbor looked very different now. The boats beached on rises of muddy sand. Behind the harbor rose a narrow spit of land, shingled with gray rocks. It was easy to see why it was called Chapel Cliff. The spit was tipped with gray rocks, which twisted narrowly up into the air like the spires of a church cathedral. The water had lowered enough so that a great deal of the cliff was revealed. The sea had been pounding against the rocks when they'd arrived. Now it sloshed quietly in the harbor, retreating to reveal a small, sandy beach, and behind it the dark openings of several cave mouths. Above the caves, perched on the steep slope of the cliff, was a house. Emma had barely spared it a glance when they'd first arrived. It had simply been one of many small houses that dotted the side of the harbor across from the Warren, though she could see now that it was farther out along the spit of land than any of the others. In fact, it was quite distant from them, standing small and alone between the sea and sky. Its windows were boarded up. Its whitewash had peeled away in gray strips. But if Emma looked with her shadow hunter eyes, she could see more than an abandoned house. She could see the white lace curtains in the windows and new shingles on the roof. There was a mailbox nailed to the fence. A name was painted onto the box in sloppy white letters barely visible from this distance. They certainly wouldn't have been visible to a mundane, but Emma could see them. Fade. Chapter 18. Memories of the Past. Gia Penhollow was seated behind the desk in the consul's office, illuminated by the rays of the sun over Alicante. The spires of the demon towers glittered outside the window, red, gold, and orange, like shards of bloody glass. She had the same warmth in her face Diana remembered, but she looked as if much more time had passed since the dark war than 5 years. There was white in her black hair, which was pinned up elegantly on the top of her head. "It's good to see you, Diana," she said, inclining her head toward the chair opposite her desk. "We've all been very curious about your mysterious news." "I imagine," Diana sat down. "But I was hoping what I had to say would stay between the two of us." Gia didn't look surprised. Not that she would show it if she was. "I see. I'd wondered if you'd come about the Los Angeles Institute head position. I assume you'd want to take over now that Arthur Blackthorne is dead." Her graceful hands fluttered as she shuffled and stacked papers, slotted pens into their holders.
It was very brave of him to approach the convergence alone. I was sorry to hear he was slain.
Diana nodded. For reasons none of them knew, Arthur's body had been found near the destroyed convergence site, covered in blood from his cut throat and in stains of ichor that Julian told her grimly were Malcolm's blood. There was no reason to contradict the official assumption that he had waged a solo assault on the convergence and been killed by Malcolm's demons.
At least Arthur would be remembered as brave, though it gave her a pang that he had been burned and buried without his nieces and nephews there to mourn him. That in fact no one in the wider world would know he had sacrificed himself for his family.
Livy had said to her that she hoped they would be able to have a remembrance ceremony for him when they all went to Idris. Diana hoped so, too.
Gia didn't seem nonplussed by Diana's silence. Patrick remembers Arthur from when they were boys, she said, though I'm afraid I never knew him. How are the children coping?
The children? How did you explain that the Blackthorns' second father had been their older brother since he was 12 years old? That Julian and Emma and Mark weren't children at all, really, having suffered enough for most adults' entire lifetimes. That Arthur Blackthorne had never really run the Institute, and the whole idea that he needed to be replaced was like an elaborate and terrible joke.
The children are devastated, Diana said. Their family has been fragmented, as you know. What they want is to return to Los Angeles, their home.
But they cannot return while there is no one to head the Institute, which is why I thought you—
I don't want it to be me, Diana said. I'm not here to ask for that job. But neither do I want it to go to Zara Dearborn and her father.
Really? Said Gia. Her tone was neutral, but her eyes glittered with interest.
If not the Dearborns and not you, then who?
If Helen Blackthorne was allowed to return,
Gia sat up straight,
and run the Institute? You know the Council would never allow—
Then let Aline run the Institute, said Diana. Helen could simply remain in Los Angeles as her wife, and be with her family.
Gia's expression was calm, but her hands gripped the desk tightly.
Aline is my daughter. You think I don't want to bring her home?
I've never known what you thought, Diana said. It was true. She had no children. But if it had been her sister who had been exiled, she couldn't imagine not fighting tooth and claw to have her released.
When Helen was first exiled, and Aline chose to go with her, I thought about resigning as consul, said Gia, her hand still taut. I knew I had no power to reverse the Clave's decision.
The consul is not a tyrant who can impose her choices on the unwilling. Usually I would say that was a good thing, but I will tell you, for a long time, I wished I could be a tyrant.
Why not resign, then? I didn't trust who might come after me, said Gia simply. The cold piece was very popular. If the consul who followed me wished to, they could separate Aline from Helen. And though I want my daughter home, I don't want her heartbroken. They could do worse, too. They could try Aline and Helen as traitors, turn Helen's sentence of exile into one of death. Maybe Aline's as well. Anything was possible.
Her gaze was dark and heavy.
I remain where I am to stand between my daughter and the Clave's darker forces.
Then aren't we on the same side? Diana said. Don't we want the same thing?
Gia gave a flat smile.
What separates us, Diana, is 5 years. 5 years of me trying everything to get the Council to reconsider. Helen is their example, their way of saying to the fair folk, look, we take the cold piece so seriously we even punish our own. Every time the issue comes up for a vote, I am voted down.
But what if other circumstances presented themselves?
What other circumstances did you have in mind?
Diana rolled her shoulders back, feeling the tension prickle along her spine.
Jace Herondale and Clary Fairchild were dispatched to Ferry for a mission, she said. It was half a guess. While the two of them had been at the Institute, she had glimpsed the contents of their bags. Both had been packed with iron and salt. Yes, said Gia. We have received several messages since they left. Then they've told you, said Diana, about the blight on the Unseelie King's lands. Gia sat arrested, one hand hovering over her desk. No one knows what they told me but the Inquisitor and myself, she said. How did you know? It doesn't matter. I'm telling you because I need you to believe that I know what I'm talking about, said Diana. I know that the Unseelie King hates Nephilim, and that he has uncovered some force, some magic, that renders our powers useless. He has made it so that there are parts of his kingdom where runes do not work, where seraph blades will not light. Gia frowned. Jason Clary didn't mention anything so specific, and they've had no contact with anyone but me since they entered Faerie. There is a boy, said Diana. A fairy, a messenger from the Seelie court, Kieran. He's also a prince of Unseelie. He knows some of what his father plans. He's willing to testify in front of the council. Gia looked bewildered. An Unseelie prince would testify for the Seelie court? And what is the Seelie court's interest? The Seelie queen hates the Unseelie king, said Diana. More, apparently, than she hates shadow hunters. She is willing to commit the forces of her army to defeating the Unseelie King, to wiping out his power and reversing the blight on his lands. Out of the kindness of her heart, Gia raised an eyebrow. In exchange for the end of the Cold Peace, said Diana. Gia gave a short bark of laughter. No one will agree to that. The Clave, everyone is sick of the Cold Peace, except the most extreme bigots, said Diana. And I don't think either of us want to see them gain power. Gia sighed. You mean the Dearborns and the cohort. I spent quite a bit of time with Zara Dearborn and her Centaurian friends at the Institute, said Diana. Her views are not pleasant. Gia stood up, turning toward the window. She and her father seek to return the Clave to a lost golden age, a time that never was, when Downworlders knew their place, and Nephilim ruled in harmony. In truth, that past was a violent time, when Downworlders suffered, and those Nephilim who possessed compassion and empathy were tormented and punished along with them. How many of them are there? Diana asked. The cohort. Zara's father, Horace Dearborn, is the unofficial leader, said Gia. His wife is dead, and he has raised his daughter to follow in his footsteps. If he succeeds in placing himself at the head of the Los Angeles Institute, she will rule from beside him. Then there are other families, the Larkspears, the Bridgestocks, the Crossgills. They're scattered around the world. And their goal is to continue restricting downworlder rights, registering them all, giving them numbers. Forbidding their marriages to shadow hunters, Diana shrugged. It's all part of a peace, isn't it? First you number people, then you restrict their rights and break up their marriages, then... No, Gia's voice was gritty. We can't let this happen. But you don't understand. Zara's being put forth as the great new shadow hunter of her generation, the new Jace Herondale, since she killed Malcolm. Diana bolted up out of her chair. That lying girl did not kill Malcolm. We know Emma didn't, she said. He returned. I am aware of exactly how he died, said Diana. He raised Annabelle Blackthorne from the dead. She killed him. What? Gia sounded shocked. It's the truth, Consul. Diana, you would need proof that what you're saying is true. A trial by mortal sword. Diana's greatest fear. No, she said. It wouldn't be just my secrets I'd be revealing. It would be Julian's, Emma's. They'd all be ruined. You must see how this looks, Gia said, as if you're seeking a way to keep the Los Angeles Institute under your control by discrediting the Dearborns. They discredit themselves. Diana looked hard at Gia. You know, Zara, she said. Do you really think she killed Malcolm? No, Gia said after a pause. I don't. She went to an ornate carved cabinet against one wall of her office. She slid open a drawer. I need time to think about this, Diana. In the meantime, she drew out a thick, cream-colored folder full of papers. This is Zara Dearborn's report on the death of Malcolm Fade and the attacks on the L.A. Institute. Perhaps you can find some discrepancies that might discredit her story. Thank you, Diana took the folder. And the council meeting? A chance for Kieran to give testimony? I'll discuss it with the Inquisitor. Gia suddenly looked even older than she had before. Go home, Diana. I'll summon you tomorrow.
We should have brought Drew, Livy said, standing inside the gates of Blackthorn Hall. This is every horror movie fantasy she's ever had come true.
Blackthorn Hall turned out to be in a suburb of London, not far from the Thames River. The area around it was ordinary. Red brick houses, bus stops plastered with movie posters, kids riding by on bicycles. After days trapped in the Institute, even the foreignness of London felt to Kit like waking up to reality after a dream. Blackthorn Hall was glamored, which meant that mundanes couldn't see it. Kit had a sort of double vision when he glanced at it for the first time. He could see a pleasant but dull-looking private park, superimposed over a massive house with towering walls and gates, its stones blackened by years of rain and neglect. He squinted hard. The park vanished, and only the house remained. It loomed overhead. It looked to Kit a little like a Greek temple, with columns holding up the arched portico in front of a set of double doors, massive and made from the same metal as the fence that ran all the way around the property. It was high, tipped with sharp points. The only entrance was a gate, which Ty made short work of with one of his runes.
"What's that one mean?" Kit had asked, pointing as the gate creaked open with a puff of rust. Ty looked at him.
"Open." "I was going to guess that," Kit muttered as they headed inside. Now, within the property, he gazed around in wonder. The gardens might have fallen into disrepair now, but you could see where there had been rose arbors and marble balustrades holding up massive stone jugs spilling flowers and weeds. There were wildflowers everywhere. It was beautiful in its own odd, ruined way. The house was like a small castle. The circlet of thorns that Kit recognized as the Blackthorn family symbol stamped into the metal front doors and onto the tops of columns.
"Looks haunted," said Livy as they went up the front steps.
In the distance, Kit could see the pitch-black circle of an old ornamental pond. Around it were a set of marble benches. A single statue of a man in a toga regarded him with blank, worried eyes.
"There used to be a whole collection of statues of different Greek and Roman playwrights and poets here," said Livy, as Ty went to work on the doors. "Uncle Arthur had most of them shipped to the L.A. Institute."
"The open rune's not working," said Ty, straightening up and looking at Kit as if he knew everything Kit was thinking, as if he knew everything Kit had ever thought. There was something about being the focus of Tiberius's gaze that was frightening and thrilling all at once. "We have to figure another way in." Ty pushed past Kit and his sister, heading down the stairs. They made their way around the side of the hall, down a pebbled path. Hedges that had probably once been neat and clipped curved away in explosions of leaves and flowers. In the far distance, the water of the Thames shimmered.
"Maybe there's a way in through the back," Livy said. "The windows can't be that secure either."
"What about this door?" Kit pointed. Ty turned around, frowning.
"What door?"
"Here," Kit said, puzzled. He could see the door very clearly. A tall, narrow entrance with an odd symbol carved into it. He placed his hand on the old wood. It felt rough and warm under his fingers. "Don't you see it?"
"I see it now," Livy said. "But I swear it wasn't there a second ago."
"Some kind of doubled glamour," Ty said, coming up beside Kit. He had pulled up the hood of his sweater, and his face was a pale oval in between the black of his hair and the darkness of his collar. But why would Kit be able to see it?
"Maybe because I'm used to seeing glamours at the shadow market," said Kit.
"Glamours that aren't made by shadow hunters," said Livy. Glamours that aren't meant for shadow hunters to see through, said Kit. Ty looked thoughtful. There was an opaqueness to him sometimes that made it hard for Kit to tell whether Ty agreed with him or not. He did, however, put his steely to the door and began to draw the open rune. It wasn't the lock that clicked, but the hinges that popped open. They jumped out of the way as the door half fell, half sagged to the side, slamming into the wall with an echoing sound.
Don't press down so hard when you draw, Livy said to Ty. He shrugged.
The space beyond the door was dark enough for the twins to need to spark up their witch lights. The glow of them had a pearlescent whitish tint that Kit found strangely beautiful. They were in an old hallway filled with dust and the webs of scuttling spiders. Ty went ahead of Kit and Livy behind him. He suspected they were protecting him and resented it, but knew they wouldn't understand his protest if he lodged one. They went down the hall and up a long, narrow staircase, at the end of which was the rotted remains of a door. Through the door was a massive room with a hanging chandelier.
Probably a ballroom, Livy said, her voice echoing oddly in the space. Look, this part of the house is better taken care of.
It was. The ballroom was empty but clean, and as they moved through the other rooms, they found furniture shrouded in dropcloths, windows boarded carefully to protect the glass, boxes stacked in the halls. Inside the boxes were cloths and the strong smell of mothballs. Livy coughed and waved a hand in front of her face.
There's got to be a library, Ty said. Somewhere they would keep family documents.
I can't believe our dad might have visited here when he was growing up, Livy led the way down the hall, her body casting an elongated shadow. Long hair, long legs, shimmering witch light in her hand.
He didn't live here?
Kit asked. Livy shook her head.
Grew up in Cornwall, not London, but he went to school in Idris.
Idris. Kit had read more about Idris in the London Institute Library. The fabled homeland of the shadow hunters. A place of green forests and high mountains, icy cold lakes, and a city of glass towers. He had to admit that the part of him that loved fantasy movies and Lord of the Rings yearned to see it. He told that part of himself to be quiet. Idris was shadow hunter business, and he hadn't yet decided he wanted to be a shadow hunter. In fact, he was quite, nearly totally, sure he didn't.
Library, Ty said. It occurred to Kit that Ty never used five words when one would do. He was standing in front of the door to a hexagonal room. The walls beside him hung with paintings of ships. Some were cocked at odd angles as if they were plunging up or down waves. The library walls were painted dark blue. The only art in the room, a marble statue of a man's head and shoulders sitting atop a stone column. There was a massive desk and multiple drawers that turned out to be disappointingly empty. Forays behind the bookshelves and under the rug also turned up nothing but dust balls.
Maybe we should try another room, Kit said, emerging from under an escritoire with dust in his blonde hair.
Ty shook his head, looking frustrated.
There's something in here. I have a feeling.
Kit wasn't sure Sherlock Holmes operated on feelings, but he didn't say anything, just straightened up. As he did, he caught sight of a piece of paper sticking out of the edge of the small writing desk. He pulled at it, and it came away. It was old paper, worn almost to transparency. Kit blinked. On it was written his name. Not his name, but his last name, Herondale. Over and over, entwined with another name, so that the two words formed looping patterns. The other word was Blackthorn. A deep sense of unease shot through him. He tucked the paper quickly into his jeans pocket, just as Ty said, "Move, Kit. I want to get a closer look at that bust."
To Kit, bust only meant one thing, but since the only breast in the room belonged to Ty's sister, he stepped aside with alacrity.
Ty strode over to the small statue on the marble column. He'd pulled his hood down, and his hair stood up around his head, soft as the downy feathers of a black swan. Ty touched a small placard below the carving. The difficulty is not so great to die for a friend as to find a friend worth dying for, he said. Homer, said Livy. Whatever kind of education the Shadow Hunters got, Kit had to admit, it was thorough. Apparently, said Ty, pulling a dagger out of his belt. A second later, he'd driven the blade into the carved eye socket of the statue. Livy yelped.
Ty, what?
Her brother yanked the blade back out and repeated the action on the statue's second eye socket. This time something round and glimmering popped out of the hole in the plaster with an audible crack. Ty caught it in his left hand. He grinned, and the grin changed his face completely. Ty, when he was still and expressionless, had an intensity that fascinated Kit. When he was smiling, he was extraordinary.
What did you find?
Livy darted across the room, and they gathered around Tiberius, who was holding out a many-faceted crystal, the size of a child's hand.
And how did you know it was there?
When you said Homer's name, said Ty, I recalled that he was blind. He's almost always depicted with his eyes shut or with a cloth blindfold, but this statue had open eyes. I looked a little closer and saw that the bust was marble, but the eyes were plaster. After that, it was
elementary, said Kit.
You know Holmes never says elementary, my dear Watson, in the books, said Ty. I swear I've seen it in the movies, Kit said, or maybe on TV. Who would ever want movies or TV when there are books, said Ty with disdain.
Could someone here pay attention?
Livy demanded, her ponytail swinging in exasperation.
What is that thing you found, Ty?
An Alethea crystal. He held it up so it caught the glow of his sister's witchlight.
Look.
Kit glanced at the faceted surface of the stone. To his surprise, a face flashed across it, like an image seen in a dream. A woman's face, clouded around with long, dark hair.
Oh! Livy clapped her hand over her mouth. She looks a little like me, but how?
An Alethea crystal is a way of capturing or transporting memories. I think this one is of Annabelle, said Ty.
Alethea is Greek, said Livy. She was the Greek goddess of truth, said Kit. He shrugged when they stared at him. 9th grade book report.
Ty's mouth crooked at the corner.
Very good, Watson.
Don't call me Watson, Kit said.
Ty ignored this. We need to figure out how to access what's trapped in this crystal, he said, as quickly as possible. It would help Julian and Emma. You don't know how to get into it? Kit asked.
Ty shook his head, clearly disgruntled. It's not Shadowhunter magic. We don't learn other kinds. It's forbidden.
This struck Kit as a stupid rule. How were you ever supposed to know how your enemies operated if you made it forbidden to learn about them?
We should go, Livy said, hovering in the doorway. It's starting to get dark. Demon time.
Kit glanced toward the window. The sky was darkening, the stain of twilight spreading across the blue. The shadows were coming down over London.
I have an idea, he said. Why don't we take it to the shadow market here?
I know my way around the market. I can find a warlock or even a witch to help us get whatever's in that thing. The twins glanced at each other. Both were clearly hesitant.
We're not really supposed to go to shadow markets, said Livy.
So tell them I ran off there and you had to catch me, said Kit. If you ever have to explain, which you won't. Neither of them spoke, but Kit could see curiosity in Ty's gray eyes.
Come on, he said, pitching his voice low the way his father had taught him, the tone you used when you wanted to convince people you really meant something.
When you're home, Julian never lets you go anywhere. Now's your chance. Haven't you always wanted to see a shadow market?
Livy broke first. Okay, she said, casting a quick look at her brother to see if he agreed with her.
Okay, if you know where it is.
Ty's pale face lit with excitement. Kit felt the same spark transfer to him. The shadow market. His home, his sanctuary, the place he had been raised. Trailing around after demons and artifacts with Livy and Ty, they were the ones who knew everything,
while he knew nothing. But at the shadow market, he could shine. He'd shock them, impress them. And then, maybe, he'd cut and run away.
The shadows were lengthening by the time Julian and Emma finished their lunch. Julian bought some food and supplies at a small grocer shop, while Emma darted next door to pick up pajamas and t-shirts at a small New Age shop that sold tarot cards and crystal gnomes. When she emerged, she was grinning. She produced a blue and purple t-shirt emblazoned with a smiling unicorn for Jules, who stared at it in horror. She tucked it into his pack carefully before they started across the town to find the beginning of the path that led up and around the coast. The hills sloped up steeply from the water. It wasn't an easy climb. Marked only as to the cliffs, the path wound up through the outskirts of town, and the precariously perched houses, all of which looked as if they might at any moment tumble down into the Half Moon Harbor. Shadow hunters were trained for much more than this kind of exertion, though, and they made good time. Soon they were out of the town proper and walking up a narrow path, the hill rising farther on their right, falling down toward the sea on their left. The sea itself was luminous deep blue, glowing like a lamp. Clouds the color of seashells twined across the sky. It was beautiful in a completely different way than the sunset over the Pacific. Instead of the stark colors of sea and desert, everything here was soft pastels, greens, blues, and pinks. What was stark was the cliffs themselves. They were climbing closer to the chapel part of Chapel Cliff, the rock promontory that jutted out into the ocean, the spikes of gray stone that crowned it, ominously black against the rosy sky. The hill was gone. They were out on the spit of the land itself, long gray slate shingles that looked like a pack of playing cards shuffled and then scattered, tumbled steeply away on either side, down toward the sea. The house that they had seen from town was nestled among the rocks, the spiked crown of the stone chapel rising behind it. As Emma neared it, she felt the force of its glamour almost as a wall pushing her back. Jules had slown too. "There's a placard here," he said. "Says this place belongs to the National Trust, no trespassers." Emma made a face. "No trespassers usually means the local kids have made it into a hangout, and the whole place is covered with empty candy wrappers and booze bottles." "I don't know. The glamour here is really strong. It's not just visual, but emotional. You can feel it, right?" Emma nodded. The cottage was giving off waves of stay away and danger and nothing here you want to see. It was a bit like being shouted at by an angry stranger on a bus. "Take my hand," Julian said. "What?" She turned in surprise. He was holding his hand out. She could see the faint smatter of colored pencil on his skin. He flexed his fingers. "We can get through this better together," he said. "Concentrate on pushing it back." Emma took his hand, accepting the shock that went through her at his touch. His skin was warm and soft, rough where there were calluses. He tightened his fingers around hers. They moved forward past the gate and onto the path leading up to the front door. Emma imagined the glamour as a curtain, as something she could touch. She imagined drawing it aside. It was hard, like lifting a weight with her mind, but strength flowed through her from Julian, through her fingers and wrist, up her arm, and into her heart and lungs. Her concentration snapped into focus. Almost casually, she let herself draw the glamour away, lifting it lightly aside. The cottage sprang into clearer view. The windows weren't boarded up at all, but clean and whole, the front door freshly painted a bright blue. Even the knob looked recently polished to a shiny bronze. Julian took hold of it and pushed, and the door swung open, welcoming them inside. The sense of something ordering them away from the cottage was gone. Emma let go of Julian's hand and stepped inside. It was too dark to see. She took her witch light out of her pocket and let its light rise up and around them. Julian, behind her, gave a low whistle of surprise. "This doesn't look deserted, not by a long shot."
It was a small, pretty room. A wooden four-poster bed stood beneath a window with a view out to the village below. Furniture that looked as if it had been hand-painted in blues, grays, and soft seaside colors was scattered out among a profusion of rag rugs. Two walls were taken up by a kitchen with all the modern conveniences, a coffee maker, a stove, a dishwasher, and granite-top counters. Neat stacks of firewood rose on either side of a stone-bound fireplace. Two doors led off to the main room. Emma investigated and found a small office with a hand-painted desk and a blue-tiled bathroom with a tub and a shower and a basin sink. She turned the shower faucets, half in disbelief, and yelped as water sprayed her. Everything seemed to be completely in working order, as if someone who lived in the cottage and took loving care of it had only just left. "We might as well stay here," Emma said, returning to the living room where Julian had flicked on the electric lights. "Way ahead of you, Carstairs," he said, opening a kitchen cabinet and starting to put the groceries away. "Nice place, no rent, and it'll be easier to search if we're here anyway." Emma set her witchlight down on the table and looked around wonderingly. "I know this seems far-fetched," she said, "but do you think Malcolm had a secret second life as a renter of adorably furnished holiday cottages? Or," Julian said, "there's an even stronger glamour on this place than we realized, and it only looks like an adorably furnished holiday cottage, while actually it's a hole in the ground full of rats." Emma threw herself down on the bed. The blanket felt like a cloud, and the mattress was heavenly after the lumpy one in the London Institute. "Best rats ever," she announced, glad they weren't going to have to stay in a bed and breakfast after all. "Imagine their tiny, furry bodies wriggling around you." Julian had turned back and was facing her, a half-grin on his face. When Emma had been small, she'd been horrified by rats and rodents. She sat up and glared at him. "Why are you trying to ruin my good time?" "Well, to be fair, this isn't a holiday. Not for us. This is a mission. We're supposed to be looking for anything that might give us an idea where Annabelle might have gone." "I don't know," Emma said. "This place looks like it's been stripped down and totally renovated. It was built so long ago. How do we know what's left of the original house? And wouldn't Malcolm have taken anything that was important to him to his house in L.A.?" "Not necessarily. I think this cottage was special to him." Julian hooked his thumbs through the belt loops of his jeans. "Look at the way he's taken care of it. This house is personal. It feels like a home. Not like that glass and steel thing he lived in L.A. "Then I guess we should start looking around." Emma tried to sound excited at the prospect, but she felt exhausted. No sleep the night before, the long trip on the train, her worry about Christina had all sapped her energy. Julian looked at her critically. "I'll make tea," he said. "That'll help." She crinkled her nose at him. "Tea? Tea is your solution? You're not even really British. You spent 2 months in England. How did they brainwash you? You don't like coffee, and you need caffeine." "I get my caffeine the way right-thinking people get it." Emma threw up her hands and stalked into the office. "From chocolate." She began to pull the drawers out of the desk. They were empty. She examined the bookshelves. Nothing interesting there, either. She started across the room to the closet and heard something creak. She turned back and knelt down, shoving the rag rug out of the way. The floor was stripped oak. Just under the rug was a square of lighter wood, and the faint black lines of seaming where the square outline of a trapdoor was visible. Emma took her steely out and placed its tip against it. "Open," she whispered, drawing the rune. There was a tearing sound. The square of wood ripped away and crumbled into chunks of sawdust, tumbling into the hole she'd uncovered. It was slightly bigger on all sides than she'd thought. In it were several small books and a large, leather-bound tome that Emma squinted at in puzzlement. Was it some kind of spell book? "Did you just blow something up?" Julian came in, his cheek smeared with something black. He glanced over Emma's shoulder and whistled. "Your classic secret floor compartment. Help me take this stuff out. You get the giant book." Emma picked up the three smaller volumes.
They were all bound in worn leather with a stamped MFB on the spines, their pages rough-edged.
It's not a book, Julian said in a slightly odd voice. It's a portfolio.
He retrieved it and carried it into the living room, Emma hurrying after him. Two steaming cups of tea stood on the kitchen island, and a fire was blazing away. Emma realized that the black stuff on Julian's face was probably ash. She pictured him kneeling here, starting a fire for them, patient and thoughtful, and felt a wave of overwhelming tenderness for him. He was already standing at the island, gently opening the portfolio. He caught his breath. The first picture was a watercolor of Chapel Cliff, seen from a distance. The colors and shapes leapt out vividly. Emma could feel the cool sea air on her neck, hear the cry of the gulls.
It's lovely, she said, sitting down opposite him on a tall stool. Annabelle did it. He touched her signature on the right-hand corner. I had no idea she was an artist.
I guess art runs in your blood, Emma said. Julian didn't look up. He was turning the pages with careful, almost reverent hands. There were many more seascapes. Annabelle seemed to have loved capturing the ocean and the curves of the land that bordered it. Annabelle had also drawn dozens of pictures of the Blackthorn Manor House in Idris, lingering on the softness of its golden stone, the beauty of its gardens, the vines of thorns that wrapped the gates.
Like the mural on the wall of your room, Emma wanted to say to Julian, but she didn't.
Julian's hand stopped on none of those, though. He paused instead on a sketch that was unmistakably of the cottage they were in at that moment. A wooden fence surrounded it, and Polperro was visible in the distance, the warren crawling up the opposite hill crowded with houses. Malcolm leaned against the fence, looking impossibly young. He clearly had not yet stopped aging. Though it was a pencil sketch, somehow the drawing caught the fairness of his hair, the oddity of his eyes. But they had been rendered in such loving lines that he looked beautiful. He seemed about to smile.
I think that they lived here 200 years ago, probably in hiding from the clave, Julian said. There's something about a place you've been with someone you love. It takes on a meaning in your mind. It becomes more than a place. It becomes a distillation of what you felt for each other. The moments you spend in a place with someone, they become part of the bricks and mortar, part of its soul.
The firelight touched the side of his face, his hair, turning them gold. Emma felt tears rise in the back of her throat and fought them back. There's a reason Malcolm didn't just let this place fall into ruins. He loved it. He cared about it because it was a place he'd been with her. Emma picked up her tea.
And maybe a place he wanted to bring her back to, she said, after he raised her.
Yes. I think Malcolm raised Annabelle's body nearby, that he planned to hide with her here, the way he had so long ago. Julian seemed to shake off the intense mood that had come on him, like a wet dog shaking water off its fur.
There's some guidebooks to Cornwall on the shelves. I'll go through them.
What have you got there? What's in the books?
Emma opened the first one.
Diary of Malcolm Fade Blackthorn, age 8, was scrawled on the inside cover.
By the angels, she said. His diaries.
She began to read out loud from the first page.
My name is Malcolm Fade Blackthorn. I chose the first two names myself, but the last was given to me to use by the Blackthorns, who have kindly taken me in. Felix says I am a ward, though I don't understand what that means. He also says I am a warlock. When he says it, I think it is probably not a good thing to be. But Annabelle says not to worry, that we are all born what we are and can't change it. Annabelle says... She broke off. This was the man who'd murdered her parents, but it was also a child's voice, helpless and wondering, echoing down through the centuries. 200 years. The diary wasn't dated, but it must have been written in the early 1800s. Annabelle says, she whispered, he fell in love with her so early.
Julian cleared his throat and stood up.
Looks like it, he said.
We'll have to search the diary for mentions of places that were important to both of them.
It's a lot of diary, she said, glancing at the three volumes.
Then I guess we've got a lot of reading ahead of us, said Julian.
I'd better make more tea.
Emma's wail of,
not tea,
followed him into the kitchen. The London Shadow Market was located at the southern end of London Bridge. Kit was disappointed to find that London Bridge was just a dull concrete edifice without towers.
I thought it would be more like it is in the postcards, he lamented.
You're thinking of Tower Bridge, Livy informed him archly as they began scrambling down a set of narrow stone steps to reach the space below the London Bridge railway lines, which crisscrossed overhead. That's the one in all the pictures. The real London Bridge was knocked down a long time ago. This one's the modern replacement. A sign advertised some kind of daytime fruit and vegetable market, but that had long since closed. The white painted stalls were battened down tightly, the gates locked. The shadow of Suffolk Cathedral loomed over it all, a bulk of glass and stone that blocked their view of the river. Kit blinked away the glamour as he reached the bottom of the steps. The image tore like spider webs, and the shadow market burst into life. They were still using many of the ordinary market's stalls. Clever, he thought, to hide in plain sight like that. But they were brightly colored now, a rainbow of paint and shimmer. Tents billowed in between the stalls as well, made of silks and draperies, signs floating beside their openings, advertising everything from fortune-telling to luck charms to love spells. They slipped into the bustling crowd. Stalls sold enchanted masks, bottles of vintage blood for vampires. Livy looked like she was going to gag over the red-hot cherry flavor variety, and apothecaries did a brisk trade in magical powders and tinctures. A werewolf with thin, pale white hair sold bottles of silvery powder, while across from him a witch whose skin had been tattooed with multicolored scales was hawking spell books. Several stands were taken up with selling shadow hunter repelling charms, which made Livy giggle. Kit was less amused.
Push your sleeves down, he said, and pull your hoods up. Cover your marks as much as you can.
Livy and Ty did as they were told. Ty reached for his headphones, too, but paused. Slowly, he looped them back around his neck.
I should keep them off, he said. I might need to hear something.
Livy squeezed his shoulder and said something to him in a low voice that Kit couldn't hear. Ty shook his head, waving her away, and they pushed farther into the market. A group of pale-skinned knights' children had gathered at a stall advertising willing victims here. A crowd of humans sat around a deal table, chatting. Occasionally, another vampire would come up, money would change hands, and one of the humans would be drawn into the shadows to be bitten. Livy made a smothered noise.
They're very careful, Kit assured her. There's a place like this in the L.A. market. The vamps never drink enough to hurt anyone.
He wondered if he should say something else reassuring to Ty. The dark-haired boy was pale, with a fine sheen of sweat along his cheekbones. His hands were opening and closing at his sides. Farther along was a stall advertising a raw bar. Werewolves surrounding a dozen fresh carcasses of animals, selling bloody hunks torn off in fistfuls by passing customers. Livy frowned. Ty said nothing. Kit had noticed before that puns and language jokes didn't interest Ty much. And right now, Ty looked as if he were struggling between trying to take in the details of the market and not throwing up.
Put your headphones on, Livy murmured to him. It's all right.
Ty shook his head again. His black hair was sticking to his forehead. Kit frowned. He wanted to grab Ty and drag him out of the market to somewhere it would be calm and quiet. He remembered Ty saying that he hated crowds, that the sheer noise and confusion was like broken glass in my head. There was something else, too, something odd and off about this market.
I think we've wandered into the food area, said Livy, making a face. I wish we hadn't.
This way. Kit turned more toward the cathedral.
Usually there was a section of the market where warlocks grouped together. So far he'd only seen vampires, werewolves, witches, and...
He slowed almost to a stop. No ferries, he said.
What?
Livy asked, nearly bumping into him. The market is usually full of ferries, he said. They sell everything from invisibility clothes to sacks of food that are never empty. But I haven't seen a single one here.
I have, said Ty. He pointed.
Nearby was a large stall manned by a tall male witch with long braided gray hair. In front of the stall was a green baize table. Displayed on the table were antique bird cages made of white-painted wrought iron. Each one was quite pretty in its own right, and for a moment Kit thought that they were what was for sale. Then he looked closer. Inside each cage was a small, trapped creature. An assortment of pixies, nixies, brownies, and even a goblin, whose wide eyes were nearly swollen shut, probably from so much proximity to cold iron. The other fairies were chatting mournfully and softly, their hands seizing at the bars, then falling away with low cries of pain. Ty was white with distress. His hands trembled against his sides. Kit thought of Ty in the desert, stroking the small lizards, putting mice in his pockets, capturing weasels for company. Ty, whose heart went out to small and helpless living things.
We can't leave them like that.
They're probably selling them for blood and bones, said Livy, her voice shaking. We have to do something.
You have no authority here, Shadow Hunter. A cool, clipped voice spun them around. A woman stood before them. Her skin was dark as mahogany, her hair like bronze and dressed high on her head. The pupils of her eyes were shaped like golden stars. She was dressed in a glacier-white pantsuit with high, sparkling heels. She could have been any age from 18 to 30. She smiled when they looked at her.
Yes, I recognize a shadow hunter, even those clumsily hiding their marks, she said. I suggest you leave the market before someone less friendly than I am notices you. Both the twins made subtle gestures toward their weapons belts, their hands hovering near the hilts of their serif blades.
Kit knew this was his moment to show how well he could handle a market and its denizens, not to mention preventing a bloodbath.
I am an emissary of Barnabas Hale, he said, of the Los Angeles market. These shadow hunters are under my protection. Who are you?
Hypatia Vex, she said. I co-run this market.
She narrowed her starry eyes at Kit.
A representative of Barnabas, you say. Why should I believe you?
The only people who know about Barnabas Hale, said Kit, are people he wants to know. She nodded slightly.
And the Shadow Hunters? Barnabas sent them, too?
He needs me to consult a warlock regarding a peculiar magical object, said Kit. He was flying high now, high on the lies and the trickery and the con. They have it in their possession.
Very well, then. If Barnabas sent you to consult a warlock, which warlock is it?
It was me. A deep voice spoke from the shadows.
Kit turned to see a figure standing in front of a large, dark green tent. It had been a male voice, but otherwise the figure was too covered. Massive robe, cloak, hood, and gloves, to discern gender.
I'll take this, Hypatia.
Hypatia blinked slowly. It was like the stars vanishing and then reappearing from behind a cloud.
If you insist.
She made as if to turn and stalk away, then paused, looking back over her shoulder at Livy and Ty.
If you pity those creatures, those fairies, dying inside their cages, she said, think of this. If it were not for the cold peace your people insisted on, they would not be here. Look to the blood on your own hands, shadow hunters.
She disappeared between two tents. Ty's expression was full of distress.
But my hands...
It's an expression.
Livy put her arm around her twin, hugging him tightly to her side.
It's not your fault, Ty. She's just being cruel.
We should go,
Kit said to the robed and hooded warlock, who nodded.
Come with me, he said, and slipped into his tent. The rest of them followed.
The inside of the tent was remarkably clean and plain, with a wooden floor, a simple cot bed, and several shelves filled with books, maps, bottles of powder,
candles in different colors, and jars of alarming colored liquids. Ty exhaled, leaning back against one of the tent poles. Relief was printed clearly on his face as he basked in the relative calm and quiet. Kit wanted to go over to Ty and ask him if he was all right after the cacophony of the market, but Livy was already there, brushing the sweat-damp hair off her brother's forehead. Ty nodded, said something to her Kit couldn't hear.
Come, said the warlock.
Sit down with me. He gestured. In the center of the room was a small table surrounded by chairs. The shadow hunter sat down, and the hooded warlock settled opposite them. In the flickering light inside the tent, Kit could glimpse the edge of a mask behind the hood, obscuring the warlock's face.
You may call me Shade, he said. It's not my last name, but it will do.
Why did you lie for us? Livy said. Out there. You don't have any agreement with Barnabas Hale.
Oh, I have a few, said Shade. Not regarding you, to be fair, but I do know the man. And I'm curious that you do. Not many shadow hunters are even aware of his name.
I'm not a shadow hunter, said Kit.
Oh, you are, said Shade. You're that new Herondale, to be exact.
Livy's voice was sharp. How did you know that? Tell us now.
Because of your face, he said to Kit. Your pretty, pretty face. You're not the first Herondale I've met, not even the first with those eyes. Like distilled twilight. I don't know why you only have one mark, but I certainly can make a guess.
He templed his hands under his chin. Kit thought he saw a gleam of green skin at his wrist, just below the edge of his glove.
I have to say, I never thought I'd have the pleasure of entertaining the lost Herondale.
I'm not all that entertained, actually, said Kit. We could put on a movie.
Livy leaned forward.
Sorry, she said. He gets like this when he's uncomfortable, sarcastic.
Who knew that was an inherited trait?
Shade held out a gloved hand.
Now, show me what you brought. I assume that wasn't a lie.
Ty reached into his jacket and brought out the Alethea crystal. In the candlelight, it glittered more than ever. Shade chuckled.
A memory holder, he said. It looks like you might get your movie after all.
He reached out, and after a moment's hesitation, Ty allowed him to take it. Shade set the crystal delicately in the center of the table. He passed a hand over it, then frowned and removed his glove. As Kit had thought, the skin of the hand he revealed was deep green. He wondered why Shade would bother covering something like that up here in the shadow market, where warlocks were commonplace. Shade passed his bare hand over the crystal and murmured. The candles in the room began to gutter. His murmuring increased. Kit recognized the words as Latin, which he'd taken 3 months of in school, before he decided there was no point in knowing a language he couldn't converse in with anyone but the Pope, who he was unlikely to meet. He had to admit now that it had weight to it, though, a sense that each word was freighted with a deeper meaning. The candles went out entirely, but the room wasn't dark. The crystal was glowing, brighter and brighter under Shade's touch. At last, a focused beam of light seemed to explode from it, and Kit realized what Shade had meant when he joked about a movie. The light worked like the beam of a projector, casting moving images against the dark wall of the tent. A girl sat bound to a chair inside a circular room filled with benches, a sort of auditorium. Through the windows of the room, Kit could see mountains covered in snow. Though it was likely winter, the girl was wearing only a white shift dress. Her feet were bare, and her long, dark hair hung in tangles. Her face was remarkably like Livy's, so much so that to see it twisted in agony and terror made Kit tense.
Annabel Blackthorn,
a slight man with bent shoulders, entered the scene. He was dressed in black. He wore a pin, not unlike Diego's, clasped at his shoulder. His hood was drawn up. Because of that and the angle of the crystal's viewpoint, it was hard to see his face or body in much detail.
The Inquisitor, muttered Shade. He was a centurion back then.
You have come before us,
the man went on.
Accused of consorting with downworlders. Your family took in the warlock Malcolm Fade and raised him as a brother to you. He repaid their kindness with abject treachery. He stole the black volume of the dead from the Cornwall Institute, and you helped him.
Where is Malcolm?
Annabelle's voice was shaking, but also clear and firm.
Why isn't he here? I refuse to be questioned without him. How attached you are to your warlock despoiler,
sneered the Inquisitor. Livy gasped. Annabelle looked furious. She had Livy's stubborn set to her jaw, Kit thought, but there was a little of Ty and the rest in her, too. Julian's haughtiness, Drew's look of easy hurt, the thoughtful cast of Ty's mouth and eyes.
So will it disappoint you, then, to hear that he is gone?
Gone?
Annabelle repeated blankly.
Disappeared from his cell in the Silent City overnight. Abandon you to our tender mercies.
Annabelle clasped her hands tightly in her lap.
That can't be true, she said. Where is he? What have you done with him?
We have done nothing with him. I would be happy to testify to such under the grip of the mortal sword, said the Inquisitor. In fact, what we want from you now, and we will release you afterward, is Fade's location. Now, why would we want to know that unless he truly had escaped?
Annabelle was shaking her head wildly, her dark hair whipping across her face.
He wouldn't leave me, she whispered. He wouldn't.
The truth is better faced, Annabelle, said the Inquisitor. He used you to gain access to the Cornwall Institute, to thieve from it. Once he had what he wanted, he vanished with it, leaving you alone to take the brunt of our wrath.
He wanted it for our protection,
her voice trembled.
It was so we could begin a new life together, where we would be safe, safe from the law, safe from you.
The Black Volume does not contain spells of safety or protection, said the Inquisitor. The only way it could be of help to you would be if you traded it to someone powerful. Who was Fade's powerful ally, Annabelle?
She shook her head, her chin set stubbornly. Behind her, someone else was coming into the room. A stern-faced woman, carrying what looked like a bundle of black cloth. She sent a shiver up Kit's spine.
I will tell you nothing, not even if you use the sword.
Indeed. We cannot believe what you say under the sword, said the Inquisitor. Malcolm has so tainted you.
Tainted?
Annabelle echoed in horror.
As if I am filth now?
You were filth from the time you first touched him. And now we do not know how he has changed you. You may well have some protection from our instruments of justice, some charm we do not know of. So we must do this as mundanes do it.
The woman with the stern face had arrived at the Inquisitor's side. She passed him the black bundle. He unrolled it, revealing a variety of sharp instruments, knives and razors and awls. Some of them had blades already stained with rusty red.
Tell us, who has that book now? And the pain stops,
said the Inquisitor, lifting up a razor. Annabelle began to scream. Mercifully, the image went dark. Livy was pale. Ty was leaning forward, his arms clasping his body tightly. Kit wanted to reach out, wanted to put his hands on Ty, wanted to tell him it would be all right, communicated in a way that startled him. There is more, said Shade. A different scene. Look. The image on the wall shifted. They were still inside the same auditorium, but it was night, and the windows were dark. The place was lit with torches that burned white gold. They could see the Inquisitor's face now, where before they had been only able to see the edges of his dark clothes and his hands. He wasn't nearly as old as Kit had thought, a youngish man with dark hair. The room was empty except for him and a group of other men of varying ages. There were no women. The other men weren't wearing robes, but Regency-era clothes, buckskin trousers and short buttoned jackets. Several had sideburns as well, and a few had
neat-trimmed beards. They all looked agitated.
"Felix Blackthorne," said the Inquisitor, drawling a bit, "your daughter, Annabelle, was chosen to become an Iron Sister. She was sent to you for a final farewell, but I hear now from the ladies of the Adamant Citadel that she never arrived. Have you any idea of her whereabouts?"
A man with brown hair streaked with gray frowned. Kit stared at him in some fascination. Here was a living ancestor of Ty and Livy, Julian and Mark. His face was broad and bore the marks of a bad temper.
"If you suggest I'm hiding my daughter, I am not," he said. "She fouled herself with a touch of a warlock, and she is no longer part of our family."
"My uncle speaks the truth," said another of the men, this one younger. "Annabelle is dead to us all."
"What a vivid image," said the Inquisitor. "Don't mind me if I find it more than an image."
The younger man flinched. Felix Blackthorne didn't change expression.
"You would not mind a trial by mortal sword, would you, Felix?" said the Inquisitor. "Just to ensure that you truly do not know where your daughter is."
"You sent her back to us tortured and half mad," snapped the younger Blackthorne. "Do not tell us now you care about her fate."
"She was no more hurt than many shadow hunters might be in battle," said the Inquisitor. "But death is another thing entirely, and the Iron Sisters are asking."
"Might I speak?" said another of the men. He had dark hair and an aristocratic look. The Inquisitor nodded. "Since Annabelle Blackthorne went to join the Iron Sisters," he said, "Malcolm Fade has become a true ally to the Nephilim, one of those rare warlocks we can count on our side, and who is indispensable in a battle."
"Your point, Herondale."
"If he does not think his lady love left him, shall we say, voluntarily, or if he learns of any harm that came to her, I think it unlikely he will continue to be such a valuable asset to us."
"The ladies of the Adamant Citadel do not leave their island to truck in gossip," said another man, narrow-faced as a ferret. "If the discussion of the fate of unfortunate Annabelle ends here, then it ends. After all, perhaps she ran away on the road, or perhaps she fell victim to a demon or a highwayman on the way to the Citadel. We may never know."
The Inquisitor tapped his fingers on the arm of his chair. He was looking at Felix Blackthorne, his eyes hooded. It was impossible for Kit to tell what he might be thinking. Finally, he said,
"You're damnably clever, Felix, bringing your friends into this. You know I can't punish you all without chaos. And you're right about Fade. There's been a demon uprising near the Scholomance, and we need him."
He flung his hands up.
"Very well, we'll never discuss this again."
A look of relief passed over Felix Blackthorne's face, mixed with an odd bitterness.
"Thank you," he said. "Thank you, Inquisitor Dearborn."
The vision narrowed to a pinpoint of black and vanished. For a moment Kit sat still. He heard Livy and Ty speaking in rapid voices, and Shade answering, yes, the vision was a real memory, no, there was no way of identifying whose it might be. It was probably 200 years old. They were clearly excited about the mention of an Inquisitor Dearborn, but Kit's brain had snagged on one word like a piece of cloth on a hook. Herondale. One of those horrible men had been his ancestor. Herondales and Dearborns and Blackthorns together had been complicit in covering up the torture and murder of a young woman whose only crime had been to love a warlock. It had been one thing to think he was related to Jace, who seemed to be universally adored and good at everything. Everyone had spoken of Herondales to him as though they were royalty, world-saving royalty. He remembered Arthur's words.
"What kind of Herondale will you be? William or Tobias? Stephen or Jace? Beautiful, bitter, or both?"
"Rook!"
The front of the tent shook.
"Kit Rook! Come out of there! Right now!"
The chatter inside the tent stopped. Kit blinked. He wasn't Kit Rook. He was Christopher Herondale. He staggered to his feet.
Livy and Ty leapt up after him, Ty pausing only to pocket the Alethea crystal.
Kit, don't!
Livy started, reaching for him, but Kit had already shoved his way out of the tent. Someone was calling his real name, or maybe it wasn't his real name, but it was a part of him that he couldn't deny. He stumbled into the lane outside. Barnabas Hale stood in front of him, his arms crossed over his chest, his scaled white skin gleaming sickly in the torchlight. Behind him loomed a group of werewolves, big, muscular men and women in black leather and spiked bracelets. More than one sported a pair of brass knuckles.
"So, little rook," Barnabas said, his snake's tongue flickering as he grinned. "What's this I hear about you, pretending to be here on business for me?"
Chapter 19. The Grey Woods.
"I told you to stay away from the shadow market, rook," said Barnabas. "Is there a reason you didn't listen? Lack of respect for me? Or just a lack of respect for downworlders overall?"
A crowd had begun to gather, a curious mixture of sneering vampires, grinning werewolves, and wary-looking warlocks.
"You told me to stay out of the Los Angeles market," said Kit. "Not every shadow market in the world. You don't have that power and reach, Hale, and it's up to the owner of this market to decide if I stay or go."
"That would be me." It was Hypatia, her smooth face expressionless.
"I thought you were the co-runner," said Kit.
"Good enough, and watch your impertinence. I don't appreciate being lied to, child, nor do I appreciate you bringing two Nephilim in here with you."
The crowd gasped. Kit winced internally. This was not going their way.
"They don't support the cold peace," he said.
"Did they vote against it?"
asked a warlock with a ring of spikes growing from around her throat. "We were 10 years old," said Livy. "We were too young."
"Children,"
hissed the man standing behind the counter of caged fairies. It was hard to tell if he said the word with surprise, contempt, or hunger.
"Oh, he didn't just bring Nephilim with him," said Barnabas with a snake-like grin. "He is one, a shadow hunter spy."
"What do we do?" Ty whispered. They were now pressed so tightly together that Kit couldn't move his arms, pinned between Ty and Livy.
"Get your weapons," said Kit, "and get ready to figure out how to run."
To the twins' credit, neither gave so much as an intake of breath. Their hands moved quickly at the periphery of Kit's vision.
"That's a lie," he said. "My father is Johnny Rook."
"And your mother?" said the deep voice of Shade behind them. A crowd had gathered behind them, too. They couldn't run that way.
"I don't know," said Kit between his teeth.
To his surprise, Hypatia raised her eyebrows as if she knew something he didn't.
"And it doesn't matter. We didn't come here to harm you or spy on you. We needed a warlock's help."
"But Nephilim have their own pet warlocks," said Barnabas. "Those willing to betray Downworld as they grub for money in the pockets of the Clave. Though after what all of you did to Malcolm..."
"Malcolm?"
Hypatia stood up straight.
"These are Blackthorns, the ones responsible for his death?"
"He only died halfway," Ty said. "He came back as a sort of sea demon for a while. He's dead now, obviously," he added, as if realizing he had somehow put his foot in it.
"This is why Sherlock lets Watson do the talking,"
Kit said to him in a hissing whisper.
"Holmes never lets Watson do the talking," Ty snapped. "Watson is backup."
"I'm not backup," said Kit, and drew a knife from his pocket.
He heard the werewolves laugh, mocking the dagger's puny dimensions, but it didn't bother him.
"Like I said," he told them, "we came here to peacefully speak to a warlock and leave. I've grown up in shadow markets. I bear them no ill will, and neither do my companions. But if you attack us, we will fight back. And then there will be others, other Nephilim, who come to avenge us. And for what? What good will it do?"
"The boy is right," said Shade. "War like this benefits no one."
Barnabas waved him away. His eyes had a fanatical gleam to them.
"But setting an example does," he said. "Let the Nephilim know what it is like to find the crumpled bodies of your children dead on your doorstep, and for there to be no restitution and no justice."
"Don't do this," Livy began.
Finish them, said Barnabas, and his pack of werewolves, as well as a few of the onlookers, sprang toward them.
Outside the cottage, the lights of Polperro gleamed like stars against the dark hillsides. The sweep of the sea was audible, the soft sound of the ocean rising and falling, the lullaby of the world. It had certainly worked on Emma. Despite Julian's best efforts with the tea, she had fallen asleep in front of the fireplace. Malcolm's diary opened beside her, her body curled like a cat's. She had been reading out loud to him from the diary before she'd fallen asleep. From the very beginning, when Malcolm had been found alone, a confused child who couldn't remember his parents and had no idea what a warlock was, the Blackthorns had taken him in, as far as Julian could tell, because they thought a warlock might be useful to them, a warlock they could control and compel. They had explained to him his true nature, and none too gently at that. Of all the family, only Annabel had shown kindness to Malcolm. They had explored the cliffs and caves of Cornwall together as children, and she had shown him how they could exchange messages secretly, using the raven as a carrier. Malcolm wrote lyrically of the seaside, its changes and tempests, and lyrically of Annabel, even when he did not know his own feelings. He loved her quick wit and her strong nature. He loved her protectiveness. He wrote of how she had defended him angrily to her cousins, and over time he began to marvel at not just the beauty of her heart. His pen skipped and stuttered as he wrote of her soft skin, the shape of her hands and mouth, the times when her hair came out of its plaits and floated around her like a cloud of shadow. Julian had almost been glad when Emma's voice had trailed off and she'd lain down, just to rest her eyes, she said, and fallen almost instantly asleep. He had never thought he would sympathize with Malcolm or think of the two of them as alike, but Malcolm's words could have been the story of the ruination of his own heart. Sometimes, Malcolm had written, someone you have known all your life becomes no longer familiar to you, but strange in a marvelous way, as if you have discovered a beach you have been visiting all your life is not made of sand but of diamonds, and they blind you with their beauty. Annabel, you have taken my life, as dull as the edge of an unused blade. You have taken it apart and put it back together in a shape so strange and marvelous, I can only wonder. There was a loud thud, a sound as if a bird had flown into the glass of one of the windows. Julian sat up straight, reaching for the dagger he'd placed on the low table next to the sofa. The thud came again, louder. Julian rose to his feet. Something moved outside the window, a flash of something white. It was gone. And then there was another thud, something thrown against the glass, like a child throwing pebbles at a friend's window to get their attention. Julian glanced at Emma. She had rolled onto her back, her eyes closed, her chest rising and falling in a regular rhythm. Her mouth was slightly open, her cheeks flushed. He went to the door and turned the knob slowly, trying to prevent it from squeaking. It opened, and he stepped out into the night. It was cool and dark, the moon dangling over the water like a pearl on the end of a chain. Around the house was uneven ground that fell away almost sheerly on one side to the ocean. The surface of the water was darkly transparent, the shape of rocks visible through it, as if Julian was looking through black glass. Julian, said a voice. Julian Blackthorne. He turned. The house was behind him. Ahead of him was Peak Rock, the tip of the cliff, and dark grass growing out of gaps between the gray stones. He raised his hand, the witchlight runestone in it. Light rayed out, illuminating the girl standing in front of him. It was as if she'd stepped out of his own drawing. Dark hair, straight as a pin. An oval face like a sad Madonna, framed by the hood of an enormous cloak. Beneath the cloak he could see thin, pale ankles and cracked shoes. Annabel, he said. The knife flew from Kit's hand. It shot across the distance between him and the approaching mob and drove straight into Barnabas Hale's shoulder. The snake-scaled warlock staggered backward and fell, yelling in pain.
"Kit!"
Livy said in amazement. He could tell she wasn't sure he'd done the right thing, but he'd never forgotten an Emerson quote that was a favorite of his father's. "When you strike at a king, you must kill him." One warlock was more powerful than a pack of werewolves, and Barnabas was their leader. Two reasons to take him out of the fight, but there was no more time to think about that because the downworlders were on them.
"Umbriel!"
shouted Livy. A blazing blade shot from her hand. She was a whirl of motion, her saber training making her fast and graceful. She spun in a deadly circle, her hair whipping around her. She was a gorgeous blur of light and dark, and arcs of blood followed her blade. Ty, wielding a short sword, had backed up against the pillar of a stall, which was clever because the stall owner was shouting at the downworlders to get back, even as they advanced.
"Oi, get away!"
yelled the stall owner, and her wares began to fly through the air, bottles of tinctures splattering against the surprised faces of werewolves and vampires. Some of the substances seemed corrosive. At least one werewolf fell back with a yell, clutching a sizzling face. Ty smiled, and despite everything that was happening, it made Kit want to smile too. He filed it away as a memory to revisit later, considering that right now a massive werewolf with shoulders like flying buttresses was careening toward him. He reached out and yanked a pole free of Shade's tent, causing the whole structure to tilt. Kit swung out with a pole. It wasn't the hardest metal, but it was flexible like a massive whip. He heard the crunch of bone against skin as it slammed the leaping werewolf directly in the sternum. With a grunt of agony, the lycanthrope went sailing past Kit's head. Kit's body thrummed with excitement. Maybe they could do it. Maybe the three of them could fight their way out of this. Maybe that was what it meant to have heaven in your blood. Livy screamed. Kit knocked a vampire out of his way with a vicious whack of the pole and spun to see what had happened. One of the bottles flying through the air had smashed against her side. It was clearly an acidic substance. It was burning through the material of her clothes, and though her hand was clamped against the wound, Kit could see blood between her fingers. She was still slashing out with her other hand, but the downworlders, like sharks smelling blood, had turned away from Ty and Kit and were moving toward her. She hit out, spearing too, but without being able to properly shield her body, her circle of protection was shrinking. A vampire stepped nearer, licking his lips. Kit began to run toward her. Ty was ahead of him, using his short sword to hack his way through the crowd. Blood was pattering down on the ground at Livy's feet. Kit's heart tensed with panic. She slumped just as Ty reached her, and the two of them slumped down on the ground, Livy in her brother's arms. Umbriel clattered from her hand. Kit staggered toward the two of them. He threw his pole aside, hitting several werewolves, and snatched up Livy's serif blade. Ty had put down the short sword. He was holding his sister, who was unconscious, her hair spilling across his shoulders and chest. He had a steely out and was tracing a healing rune on her skin, though his hand was shaking and the rune was uneven. Kit held up the blazing sword. The light of it made the downworlders cringe back slightly, but he knew it wasn't enough. They would press on and tear him apart, and then they would tear apart Livy and Ty. He saw Barnabas, his suit soaked in blood, leaning on the arm of a bodyguard. His eyes, fixed on Kit, were filled with hate. There would be no mercy here. A wolf leapt toward Kit. He raised Umbriel, swung it, and connected with nothing. The wolf had tumbled to the ground as if shoved by an unseen hand. There was a blast of wind. Kit's gold hair blew across his face. He pushed it back with a hand stained red. The tents were rattling. More jars and bottles smashed. Blue lightning crackled, and a fork of it stabbed into the ground just in front of Barnabas.
"I see," said a silky voice, "that I seem to have arrived here just in time." Walking toward them was a tall man with short, black, spiked hair. He was clearly a warlock. His eyes were cat's eyes, with slit pupils, green and gold.
He wore a charcoal trench coat, dramatically lined with red, that swept out behind him when he walked.
Magnus Bing, said Barnabas with clear loathing. The ultimate traitor.
Not my favorite nickname, Magnus said, gently wiggling his fingers in Barnabas's direction. I prefer Our Lord and Master, or maybe unambiguously the hottest. Barnabas shrank back.
These three Nephilim broke into the market under false pretenses.
Did they break the accords?
Barnabas snarled. One of them stabbed me.
Which one? Magnus asked. Barnabas pointed to Kit.
Dreadful business, Magnus said. His left hand was down by his side. Surreptitiously, he gave Kit a thumbs up.
Was that before or after you attacked them?
After, Kit said. One of Barnabas's bodyguards started toward him. He jabbed out with his blade. This time, the lightning that forked from Magnus's hand snapped like a downed electrical wire between their feet.
Stop, he said. You have no authority here, Bane, said Barnabas.
Actually, I do, said Magnus. As the warlock representative to the Council of Shadowhunters, I have a great deal of authority. I imagine you know that.
Oh, we know entirely how enthralled to Shadowhunters you are.
Barnabas was so furious, saliva flew when he spoke.
Especially the Lightwoods.
Magnus raised a lazy eyebrow. Is this about my boyfriend? Jealous, Barnabas? Kit cleared his throat.
Mr. Bane, he said. He'd heard of Magnus Bane. Everyone had. He was probably the most famous warlock in the world.
His boyfriend Alec helped head up the Downworlder Shadowhunter Alliance, along with Maya Roberts and Lily Chen.
Livy lost a lot of blood. Ty's using a healing rune, but...
Magnus's face darkened with real anger.
She's 15 years old. She's a child, he snarled. How dare you all?
Going to report us to the council, Magnus? Said Hypatia, speaking for the first time.
She hadn't joined in the melee. She was leaning against the side of a stall, eyeing Magnus up and down. Shade seemed to have vanished. Kit had no idea where he'd gone.
It seems to me we have two choices, said Magnus. You fight me, and you will not win, believe me, because I am very angry, and I am older than any of you. And then I tell the council. Or you let me walk away with these Nephilim children. We don't fight, and I don't report you to the council. Thoughts?
I pick number two, said the woman who'd thrown her bottles at the werewolves.
She's right, Barnabas, said Hypatia. Step back.
Barnabas's face was working. He turned abruptly on his heel and strode away, followed by his bodyguards. The other downworlders began to shuffle away, disappearing into the crowd, shoulders hunched. Kit dropped down on his knees next to Ty, who had barely moved. His eyes were darting back and forth, his lips almost white. He looked as if he was in shock.
Ty, Kit said hesitantly, and put a hand on the other boy's arm. Ty.
Ty shook him off almost without seeming to register who he was. His arms were around Livy, his fingers pressed to her wrist. Kit realized he was taking her pulse. It was clear she was alive. Kit could see the rise and fall of her chest, but Ty kept his fingers on her wrist regardless, as if the pulse of her heartbeat steadied him. Tiberius. It was Magnus kneeling down, heedless of the blood and mud spattering his expensive-looking coat. He didn't reach out or try to touch Ty, just spoke in a low voice. Tiberius, I know you can hear me. You have to help me get Livy to the Institute. I can take care of her there. Ty looked up. He wasn't crying, but the gray in his eyes had darkened to a searing charcoal. He looked stunned.
She'll be all right, he said.
She'll be fine. Magnus's voice was firm. Kit reached out to help Tiberius lift Livy, and this time Ty let him do it. As they stood up, Magnus was already creating a portal, a whirl of blue and green and rose colors, rising up against the shadows of the tents and stalls of the market.
Ty turned suddenly to Kit. Can you take her? He said. Carry Livy.
Kit nodded in astonishment. For Ty to let him carry his twin was a sign of trust that shocked him. He lifted Livy in his arms, the scent of blood and magic in his nose.
Come on,
Magnus called. The portal was wide open now. Kit could see the shape of the London Institute through it. Ty didn't turn. He had slammed his headphones down over his ears and was running through the empty lane of the market. His shoulders were hunched, as if he were warding off blows that came from all sides, but his hands were steady when he reached the stall at the end, the one with the caged fairies. He began seizing the cages, yanking them open one by one. The pixies and nixies and hobgoblins inside poured out, yelping with joy at their freedom.
You, stop that!
Shouted the stall owner, running back to prevent further destruction, but it was already too late. Ty flung the last cage toward him, and it burst open, releasing a furious, clawing hobgoblin who fastened his teeth into his former captor's shoulder.
Ty!
Kit called, and Ty ran back toward the open portal. Knowing Ty was behind him, Kit stepped into it, holding Livy tight, and let the whirlwind take him. Annabelle came toward him silently, her cracked shoes making no sounds on the rock. Julian couldn't move. He was rooted to the spot with disbelief. He knew she was alive. He'd watched her kill Malcolm, but somehow he'd never imagined her as so tangible and distinct, so human. She seemed like someone he might meet anywhere, in a movie theater, at the Institute, at the beach. He wondered where she'd gotten the clothing from. The cloak didn't seem like something you'd find hanging on a washing line, and he doubted she had any money. The high rocks threw their shadows down as she came closer to him, pushing her hood back.
How did you find this place? She demanded. This house.
He held up his hands and she stopped, only a few feet from him. The night wind picked up strands of her hair and they seemed to dance.
The Piskies told me where you were, she said. Once they were Malcolm's friends, and still they hold affection for me.
Was she serious? Julian couldn't tell.
You should not be here, she said. You should not be looking for me.
I have no desire to hurt or harm you, Julian said. He wondered if he moved closer to her, would he be able to grab her? Though the idea of using physical force to try to get the black volume sickened him, he realized he hadn't imagined how he was going to get it away from her. Finding her had been too much of a priority. But I saw you kill Malcolm.
I remember this place. 200 years past, she said as if he hadn't spoken.
Her accent was British, but there was an oddness to it, a sound Julian had never heard before.
It looked much the same, though there were fewer houses and more ships in the harbor.
She turned back to look at the cottage.
Malcolm built that house himself, with his own magic.
Why didn't you come inside? Julian said. Why did you wait for me out here?
I am barred, she said. Malcolm's blood is on my hands. I cannot enter his home.
She turned to face Julian.
How could you have seen me kill him?
The moon had come out from behind a cloud. It lit the night up brilliantly, framing the ragged edges of the clouds with light. I watched Malcolm raise you, Julian said, in the scrying glass of the Seely Queen. She wanted me to see it.
But why would the Queen want such a thing?
Her lips parted in realization.
Ah, to make you want to follow me. To make you want the black volume of the dead and all its power.
She reached into the cloak and drew out the book. It was black, a dense sort of black that seemed to gather shadows into itself. It was tied closed with a leather strap. The words stamped onto its cover had long faded away.
I remember nothing of my death, Annabelle said softly, as Julian stared at the book in her hands. Not how it was done, nor the time after when I lay beneath the earth, or when Malcolm learned of my death and disturbed my bones. I only discovered later that Malcolm had spent many years trying to raise me from the dead. But during that time,
None of the spells he cast worked. My body rotted, and I did not wake. She turned the book over in her hands. It was the Unseelie King who told him that the black volume was the key. The Unseelie King who gave him the rhyme and the spell. And it was the king who told Malcolm when Sebastian Morgenstern's attack on the Institute would come, when it would be empty. All the king asked for in return was that Malcolm worked for him on spells that would weaken the Nephilim. Julian's mind raced. Malcolm hadn't mentioned the Unseelie King's part in all this when he told them his version of the story to the Blackthorns, but that was hardly surprising. The king was far more powerful than Malcolm, and the warlock would have been reluctant to invoke his name. In the Unseelie lands, our powers are useless, said Julian. Seraph blades don't work there, or witchlight or runes. Malcolm's doing, she said. As it is in his own lands, so the king wishes it to be all over the world, and in Idris. Shadow hunters made powerless. He would take Alicante and rule from it. Shadow hunters would become the hunted. I need the black volume, Annabelle, Julian said, to stop the king, to stop all this. She only stared at him. 5 years ago, she said, Malcolm spilled Shadow Hunter blood, trying to raise me. Emma's parents, Julian thought. It woke my mind, but not my body, Annabelle said. The spell had half worked. I was in agony, you understand? Half alive and trapped beneath the earth. I screamed my pain in silence. Malcolm could not hear me. I could not move. He thought me insensible, unhearing, yet he spoke to me nonetheless. 5 years, Julian thought. For 5 years she had been trapped in the Convergence Tomb, conscious but unable to be heard, unable to speak or scream or move. Julian shuddered. His voice filtered down into my tomb. He read me that poem over and over. It was many and many a year ago. Her gaze was bleak. He betrayed me while I lived, and again when I was dead. Death is a gift, you understand, the passing beyond pain and sorrow. He denied me that. I'm sorry, Julian said. The moon had started to sink in the sky. He wondered how late it was. Sorry, she echoed dismissively, as if the word had no meaning for her. There will be a war, she said, between fairy and shadow hunters. But that is not my concern. My concern is that you promise to no longer try to obtain the black volume. Let it alone, Julian Blackthorn. He exhaled. He would have lied in a moment and promised, but he suspected a promise to someone like Annabelle would hold a terrifying weight. I can't, he said. We need the black volume. I cannot tell you why, but I swear it will be kept safe and out of the hands of the king. I have told you what the book did to me, she said, and for the first time she seemed animated, her cheeks flushed. It has no use but evil use. You should not want it. I won't use it for evil, Julian said. That much was true, he thought. It cannot be used for anything else, she said. It destroys families, people. My family will be destroyed if I don't have the book. Annabelle paused. Oh, she said, and then more gently. But think of what will be destroyed with this book out there. In the world, so much more. There are higher causes. Not to me, said Julian. The world can burn if my family lives, he thought, and was about to say it when the cottage door flew open. Emma stood in the doorway. She was shoving her feet into unlaced boots, Cortana in her hand. Her hair was rumpled over her shoulders, but her grip on the sword was unwavering. Her gaze sought out Julian, then found Annabelle. She started, stared incredulously. He saw her mouth shape Annabelle's name as Annabelle threw her hood up over her head and bolted. Julian started after her, Emma only a second behind him, but Annabelle was shockingly fast. She flew across the grass and heather-strewn slope to the edge of the cliff. With a last glance back, she flung herself into the air.
Annabelle!
Julian raced to the cliff edge, Emma at his side. He stared down into the water hundreds of feet below, untroubled by even a ripple. Annabelle had vanished. They exploded back into the Institute, appearing in the library. It was like being dropped from a great height, and Kit staggered and fell against the table, clawing at Livy so he wouldn't drop her. Ty had fallen to his knees and was righting himself. Kit glanced at Livy's face. It was gray, with an eerie, yellowish tinge. Magnus, he gasped. The warlock, who had landed with the ease of long practice, spun around, instantly assessing the situation. Calm down, he said. Everything's fine. And he started to take Livy from Kit's grasp. Kit let her go with relief. Someone was going to take care of this. Magnus Bane was going to take care of this. He wouldn't let Livy die. It took Kit a moment to notice that there was already someone standing in the library, someone he didn't know, who moved toward Magnus just as the warlock eased Livy down onto the long table. It was a young man about Jace's age, with straight dark hair that looked as if he had slept on it and not bothered to brush it. He wore a washed-out sweater and jeans. He glared at Magnus. "You woke up the kids," he said. "Alec, we have kind of an emergency here," said Magnus. So this was Alec Lightwood. Somehow Kit had expected him to look older. "Small children who are awake are also an emergency," said Alec. "I'm just saying." "All right, move the furniture back," Magnus said to Ty and Kit. "I need some working space." He glanced sideways at Alec as the two younger boys moved chairs and small bookcases out of the way. "So where are the kids?" Magnus was stripping off his coat. Alec held out his hand and caught the coat as Magnus tossed it to him, a practiced move that suggested he was used to the gesture. "I left them with a nice girl named Christina. She said she likes children." "You just left our children with strangers?" "Everyone else was asleep," said Alec. "Besides, she knows lullabies. In Spanish, Rafe is in love." He glanced over at Kit again. "By the angel, it's uncanny," he said in a sudden burst, as if he couldn't help it. Kit felt unnerved. "What's uncanny?" "He means you look like Jace," said Magnus. "Jace Herondale." "My parabatai," said Alec, with love and pride. "I know, Jace," said Kit. He was looking at Ty, who was struggling to move a chair. It wasn't that it was too heavy for him, but that his hands were opening and closing at his sides, making his gestures unusually clumsy and uncoordinated. "He came out to the L.A. Institute after they found out who I was." "The legendary Lost Herondale," said Magnus. "You know, I was starting to think that was a rumor Katarina made up, like the Loch Ness Monster or the Bermuda Triangle." "Katarina made up the Bermuda Triangle?" said Alec. "Don't be ridiculous, Alexander. That was Ragnar." Magnus touched Livy's arm lightly. She cried out. Ty dropped the chair he'd been struggling with and took a ragged breath. "You're hurting her," he said. "Don't." His voice was quiet, but in it Kit could hear steel and see the boy who'd held him at knife point at his father's house. Magnus leaned his hands on the table. "I'll try not to, Tiberius," he said, "but I may have to cause her pain to heal her." Ty seemed about to answer, just as the door flew open and Mark burst in. He caught sight of Livy and blanched. "Livy? Livia?" He tried to start forward, but Alec caught him by his arm. For all Alec's slenderness, he was deceptively strong. He held Mark back while blue fire sparked from Magnus's hand as he passed it down Livy's side. The sleeve of her jacket and shirt seemed to melt away, revealing a long, ugly cut, seeping yellow fluid. Mark sucked in a breath. "What's going on?" "Fight at the Shadow Market," Magnus said briefly. "Livia was cut with a piece of glass with an Orias root on it. Very poisonous, but curable." He moved his fingers over Livy's arm. As he did, a bluish light seemed to glow under her skin, as if it were pulsing from the inside out.
The shadow market? Mark demanded. What the hell was Livy doing at the shadow market?
Nobody answered. Kit felt as if he were shrinking inward.
What's going on?
Ty demanded. His hands were still opening at his sides, as if he were trying to shake something off his skin. His shoulders rolled back. It was as if his worry and agitation were expressing themselves through a silent music that made his nerves and muscles dance.
Is that blue light normal?
Mark said something to Alec, and Alec nodded. He released the other boy's arm, and Mark came around the table to put his hand on Ty's shoulder. Ty leaned into him, though he didn't stop moving.
Magnus is the best there is, Alec said. Healing magic is his specialty.
Alec's voice was gentle, the voice of someone who wasn't quieting his tone to keep someone calm, but who actually empathized.
Magnus cured me once, he added. It was a demon poison. I shouldn't have lived, but it did.
You can trust him.
Livy gave a sudden gasp.
Ty put his hand to his arm, his fingers clenching. Then her body relaxed. Color began to come back to her face, her cheeks turning from yellowish-gray to pink. Ty, too, relaxed visibly.
That's the poison gone, said Magnus, matter-of-factly. Now we have to work on the blood loss and the cut.
There are runes for both those things, said Ty. I can put them on her.
But Magnus was shaking his head.
Better not to use them. Runes draw some of their strength from the bearer, he said.
If she had a parabatai, we could try pulling strength from them, but she doesn't, does she?
Ty didn't say anything. His face had gone still and completely white.
She doesn't, Kit said, realizing Ty wasn't going to say anything.
That's all right, she'll be fine, Magnus reassured them. Might as well move her to the bedroom, though. No reason for her to sleep on a table.
I'll help you take her, Mark said. Ty, why don't you come with us?
Alec, can you go to the infirmary? Magnus said as Mark went to lift his sister into his arms. Poor Livy, Kit thought. She would hate to be dragged around like a sack of potatoes.
You'll know what I need.
Alec nodded.
Take Kit with you, said Magnus. You'll want help carrying everything.
Kit found himself not minding the idea of making conversation with Alec. Alec had a comforting sort of presence, quiet and contained. As he and Alec headed out of the room, Kit glanced back once at Ty. Kit had never had siblings, never had a mother, had only had Johnny, his father who had died. And he didn't think he'd ever look the way Ty looked now, as if the possibility of something happening to Livy was enough to break him inside. Maybe there was something wrong with him, Kit thought as he followed Alec into the hallway. Maybe he didn't have the right kind of feelings. He'd never wondered that much about his mother, who she was. Wouldn't someone who knew how to feel properly wonder that?
So, you met Jace, said Alec, scuffing his shoes along the carpet as they went. What do you think?
Of Jace?
Kit was puzzled. He didn't know why anyone would solicit his opinion on the head of the New York Institute.
Just making small talk.
Alec had an odd half-smile, as if he were keeping a number of thoughts to himself. They passed through a door marked infirmary into a large room filled with old-fashioned single metal beds. Alec went behind a counter and started rummaging.
Jace isn't much like you, Kit said.
There was a weird dark patch of wall across from him, as if paint had smeared up and across it in almost the shape of a tree.
That's an understatement.
Alec piled bandages on the countertop.
But it doesn't matter. Parabatai don't need to be like each other. They just need to complement each other, to work well together.
Kit thought of Jace, all shining gold and confidence, and Alec, all steady, quiet ease.
And you and Jace complement each other?
I remember when I met him, Alec said.
He'd found two boxes and was dumping bandages into one, jars of powder into another.
He walked out of a portal from Idris. He was skinny, and he had bruises, and he had these big eyes.
He was arrogant, too. He and Isabel used to fight. He smiled at the memory. But to me, everything about him said, love me, because nobody ever has. It was all over him, like fingerprints. He was worried about meeting you, Halleck added. He's not used to having living blood relatives. He cared what you thought. He wanted you to like him. He glanced over at Kit. Here, take a box. Kit's head was swimming. He thought of Jace, swaggering and amused and proud. But Alex spoke of Jace as if he saw him as a vulnerable child, someone who needed love because he'd never gotten it. I'm no one, though, he said, taking the box full of bandages. Why would he care what I think? I don't matter, I'm nothing. You matter to Shadowhunters, said Alec. You're a Herondale. That'll never be nothing. Holding Rafe in her arms, Christina sang softly. He was small for 5 years old, and his rest was fitful. He squirmed and sighed in his sleep, his small brown fingers twisted into a lock of his dark hair. He reminded her a little of her own small cousins, always wanting another hug, another sweet, another song before sleep. Max, on the other hand, slept like a rock, a dark blue rock, with adorable big navy eyes and a gap-toothed grin. When Christina, Mark, and Kieran had run down to find Alec, Magnus, and their two children in the Institute parlor, Evelyn had been there, fussing about warlocks in her house and the undesirability of being blue. Christina hoped most adult shadow hunters didn't react to Max like that. It would be awfully traumatic for the poor little mite. It seemed that Alec and Magnus had returned from a trip to find Diana's messages asking them for help. They had portaled to the London Institute immediately. On hearing about the binding spell from Mark and Christina, Magnus had headed for the local shadow market to scout out a spell book he hoped might break the enchantment. Rafe and Max, upon being left in a strange house with only one parent, had wailed. Sleep, Alec had said glumly to Rafe, carrying him into a spare room. Adorno. Christina giggled. That means ornament, she said, not sleep. Alec sighed. I'm still learning Spanish. Magnus is the one who speaks it. Christina smiled at Raphael, who was sniffling. She'd always sung her little cousins to sleep, just as her mother had with her. Maybe Rafe would like that. Oh, Rafaelito, she said to him. Oh, little Raphael baby. Ya es hora de ir a dormir. ¿Te gustaría que te cante una canción? He nodded vigorously.
Sí.
Christina spent some time teaching Alec all the lullabies she knew while she held Max and she sat with Rafe. Not long after that, Magnus had portaled back, and there had been a great deal of thumping and bumping from the library, and Alec had raced off, but Christina had decided to stay where she was unless she was called on, because the ways of warlocks were mysterious and their charming boyfriends, too. Besides, it was good to have something as harmless as a child to distract her from her anxiety. She was sure, relatively sure, that the binding spell could be undone. But it bothered her just the same. What if it couldn't? She and Mark would be miserable forever, tied by a bond they didn't want. And where would they go? What if he wanted to return to Fairy? She couldn't possibly go with him. Thoughts of Diego nagged at her, too. She thought she would come back from Fairy to a message from him, but there'd been nothing. Could someone disappear out of your life like that, twice? She sighed and leaned down to stroke Rafe's hair, singing softly. Arro mi niño, arro mi sol, arro pedazo de mi corazón. Hushabye, my baby, hushabye, my son, hushabye, oh peace of my heart. Alec had come in while she was singing and was sitting on the bed beside Max, leaning against the wall. I've heard that song before. It was Magnus, standing in the doorway. He looked tired, his cat's eyes heavily lidded. I can't remember who was singing it. He came over and bent down to take Rafe from her.
He lifted the boy in his arms, and for a moment Rafe's head lolled against his neck. Christina wondered if this had ever happened before, a shadow hunter with a warlock for a parent.
Sol solicito, caliénteme un poquito, por hoy, por mañana, por toda la semana, Magnus sang.
Christina looked at him in surprise. He had a nice singing voice, though she didn't know the melody. Sun, little sun, warm me a little for the noon, for the dawning, for all the week long.
Are you all right, Magnus? Alex said.
Fine. And Livy's fine. Healing. She'll be back to normal tomorrow.
Magnus rolled his shoulders back, stretching his muscles.
Livy?
Christina sat up in alarm.
What happened to Livy?
Alec and Magnus exchanged a look. You didn't tell her, Magnus said in a low voice.
I didn't want to upset the kids, said Alec. And I thought you could reassure her better.
Christina scrambled to her feet.
Is Livy hurt? Does Mark know?
She was reassured by both Magnus and Alec that Livy was fine and that, yes, Mark did know, but she was already halfway out the door. She bolted down the hallway toward Mark's room. Her wrist was throbbing and aching. She had been ignoring it, but it flared up now as she worried. Was it pain Mark was feeling, transmitted through the connection between them, the way parabatai sometimes feel each other's agony? Or was the binding spell getting worse, more intense? His door was half open, light spilling out from beneath it. She found him awake inside, lying on his bed. She could see the deep indentation of the binding rune, like a bracelet around his left wrist.
Christina, he sat up. Are you all right?
I'm not the one who was hurt, she said. Alec and Magnus told me about Livy.
He drew his legs up, making room for her to sit on the blanket beside him. A sudden reduction of pain in her wrist made her feel a little dizzy. He told her what they had done, Kit, Livy, and Ty, about the crystal they'd found at Blackthorn Hall, their visit to the Shadow Market, and how Livy had been injured.
I cannot help but think, he finished, that if Julian had been here, if he hadn't left me in charge, none of it would have happened.
Julian's the one who said they could go to Blackthorn Hall, and most of us are running missions at 15. It's not your fault they disobeyed.
I didn't tell them not to go to the Shadow Market, he said, shivering a little.
He pulled the patchwork blanket up around his shoulders, giving him the look of a sad harlequin.
You didn't tell them not to stab each other with knives either, because they know that, she said tartly. The market is off limits, forbidden. Although, don't be too hard on Kit. The Shadow Market is the world he knows.
I don't know how to take care of them, he said.
How do I tell them to obey rules when none of us do? We went to Ferry, a much greater breakage of the law than a visit to the Shadow Market.
Maybe you should all try taking care of each other, she said. He smiled. You're awfully wise.
Is Kieran all right, she said.
Still awake, I think, he said.
He wanders around the Institute at night. He hasn't rested well since we came here. Too much cold iron, I think. Too much city.
The neck of his t-shirt was frayed and loose. She could see where the scars on his back started, the marks of old injuries, the memory of knives. The patchwork blanket had begun to slip down his shoulder. Almost absently, Christina reached to pull it up. Her hand brushed along Mark's neck, along the bare skin where his throat met the cotton of his shirt. His skin was hot. He leaned into her. She could smell the pine of forests. His face was close enough to hers that she could make out the changing colors in the irises of his eyes. The rise and fall of her own breath seemed to lift her toward him.
Can you sleep here tonight? He said hoarsely. It will hurt less for both of us.
His inhuman eyes glittered for a moment, and she thought of what Emma had said to her, that when she looked at him sometimes she saw wildness and freedom and the unending roads of the sky.
I can't, she whispered. Christina.
He rose up to his knees. It was too cloudy outside for any moonlight or starlight, but Christina could still see him, his light hair in tangles, his eyes fixed on her. He was too close, too tangible.
She knew if he touched her, she'd crumble. She wasn't even sure what that would mean, only that the idea of such total dissolution frightened her, and that she could see Kieran when she looked at Mark, like a shadow always beside him. She slid off the bed. "I'm sorry, Mark," she said, and left the room so quickly she was almost running. "Annabelle seems so sad," Emma said. "So very sad." They were lying in the cottage bed, side by side. It was a lot more comfortable than the beds in the Institute, which was a little ironic, considering it was Malcolm's place. Julian guessed even murderers needed regular mattresses and didn't exactly sleep on platforms made of skulls. "She wanted me to leave the black volume alone," said Julian. He was lying on his back. They both were. Emma was in a pair of cotton pajamas she'd bought from the village shop, and Julian wore sweats and an old T-shirt. Their shoulders touched, and their feet. The bed wasn't very wide. Not that Julian would have moved away if he could have. She said it only brings bad things. "But you don't think we should do that?" "I don't think we have a choice. The book probably really is better off in the Seelie Court than anywhere in our world," he sighed. "She said she's been talking to the Piskies in the area. We're going to have to text the others, see if they know any Pisky trapping secrets. Get a hold of a Pisky and find out what they know."
"Okay."
Emma's voice was fading, her eyes closing. Julian felt the same exhaustion tugging at him. It had been an incredibly long day.
"You can send the message from my phone if you want."
Julian hadn't been able to plug his phone in due to not having the right adapter, things shadow hunters didn't think about. "I don't think we should tell the others Annabelle came," Julian said. "Not yet. They'll freak out, and I want to see what the Piskies say first."
"You have to at least tell them the Unseelie King helped Malcolm get the black volume," Emma said sleepily.
"I'll tell them he wrote about it in his diaries," said Julian. He waited to see if Emma would object to the lie, but she was already asleep, and Julian was nearly there. Emma was here, lying beside him, the way things were supposed to be. He realized how badly he'd slept for the past few weeks without her. He wasn't sure if he drifted off, or for how long if he had. When his eyes fluttered open, he could see the dark glow of the fire in the hearth nearly burned down to embers, and he could feel Emma beside him, her arm thrown across his chest. He froze. She must have moved in her sleep. She was curled against him. He could feel her eyelashes, her soft breath, against his skin. She murmured and turned her head against his neck. Before they climbed into bed, he'd been frightened that if he touched her, he'd feel again the same willpower-smashing desire he felt in the Seelie Court. What he felt now was both better and worse. It was an overpowering and terrible tenderness, though when awake, Emma had a presence that made her seem tall and even imposing. She was small, curled against him, and delicate enough to make his heart turn over with thoughts of how to keep the world from breaking something so fragile. He wanted to hold her forever, to protect her and keep her close. He wanted to be able to write as freely about his feelings for her as Malcolm had written about his dawning love for Annabelle. "You took my life apart and put it back together." She sighed softly, settling into the mattress. He wanted to trace the outline of her mouth, to draw it. It was always different, its heart shape changing with her expressions. But this expression, between sleeping and waking, half innocent and half knowing, caught at his soul in a new way. Malcolm's words echoed in his head. "As if you've discovered a beach you've been visiting all your life is not made of sand, but of diamonds, and they blind you with their beauty." Diamonds might be blinding in their beauty, but they were also the hardest and sharpest gems in the world. They could cut you or grind you down, smash and slice you apart.
Malcolm, deranged with love, had not thought of that. But Julian could think of nothing else. Kit was awoken by the bang of Livy's door. He sat up, aware he was aching all over, as Ty strode out of her bedroom. "You're on the floor," Ty said, looking at him. Kit couldn't deny it. He and Alec had come to Livy's room once they'd finished in the infirmary. Then Alec had gone off to check on the children, and it had just been Magnus, quietly sitting with Livy, occasionally examining her to see if she was healing. And Ty, leaning against the wall, staring unblinking at his sister. It had felt like a hospital room to which Kit shouldn't have access. So he'd gone outside, remembering how Ty had slept in front of his own door in his first days in Los Angeles. And he'd curled up on the worn carpeted floor, not expecting to get much sleep. He didn't even remember passing out, but he must have. He struggled up into a sitting position. "Wait!" But Ty was walking off down the hall, as if he hadn't heard Kit at all. After a moment, Kit scrambled to his feet and followed him. He wasn't entirely sure why. He barely knew Tiberius Blackthorne, he thought, as Ty turned almost blindly and started up a set of stairs. He barely knew his sister, either, and they were shadow hunters. And Ty wanted to form some kind of detective team with him, which was a ridiculous idea. Definitely one in which he wasn't interested at all, he told himself, as the staircase ended in a short landing in front of a worn-looking old door. And it was probably cold outside, too, he thought, as Ty pushed the door open and, yes, chilly damp air swirled in. Ty disappeared into the chill and the shadows outside, and Kit followed. They were back on the roof, though it was no longer night. To Kit's surprise, it was early morning, gray and heavy, with clouds gathering over the Thames and the Dome of St. Paul's. The noise of the city rose up, the pressure of millions of people going about their daily business, unaware of shadow hunters, unaware of magic and danger, unaware of Ty, who had gone to the railing surrounding the central part of the roof and was staring out over the city, his hands gripping the iron fleur-de-lis. "Ty?" Kit went toward him, and Tiberius turned around so his back was against the railing. His shoulders were stiff, and Kit stopped, not wanting to invade his personal space. "Are you all right?" Ty shook his head. "Cold," he said. His teeth were chattering. "I'm cold." "Then maybe we should go back downstairs," said Kit. "Inside it's warmer." "I can't." Ty's voice sounded like it was coming from a long way down, deep inside him, an echo half sunk in water. "Being in that room, I couldn't. It was..." He shook his head in frustration, as if being unable to find the words was torturing him. "Livy's gonna be fine," said Kit. "She'll be okay by tomorrow, Magnus said." "But it's my fault." Ty was pressing his back harder against the railing, but it wasn't holding him up. He slid down it until he was sitting on the ground, his knees pulled up to his chest. He was breathing hard and rocking back and forth, his hands up by his face as if to brush away cobwebs or annoying gnats. "If I was her parabat, I wanted to go to the Scholomance. But that doesn't matter. Livy matters." "It's not your fault," Kit said. Ty just shook his head hard. Kit tried frantically to remember what he'd read online about meltdowns, because he was pretty sure Ty was on his way to having one. He dropped to his knees on the damp roof. Was he supposed to touch Ty or not touch him? He could only imagine what it was like for Ty all the time, all the world rushing at him at once, blaring sounds and stabbing lights, and nobody remembering to modulate their voices, and have all the ways you usually manage that ripped away by grief or fear, leaving you as exposed as a shadow hunter going into battle without their gear. He remembered something about darkness, about pressure and weighted blankets and silence, though he had no idea how he was going to get hold of any of those things up on the top of the building. "Tell me," Kit said. "Tell me what you need." "Put your arms around me," said Ty.
His hands were pale blurs in the air, as if Kit were looking at a time-lapse photo.
Hold on to me.
He was still rocking. After a moment, Kit put his arms around Ty, not quite knowing what else to do. It was like holding a loosed arrow. Ty felt hot and sharp in his arms, and he was vibrating with some strange emotion. After what felt like a long time, he relaxed slightly. His hands touched Kit, their motion slowing, his fingers winding themselves into Kit's sweater.
Tighter,
Ty said. He was hanging on to Kit as if he were a life raft, his forehead digging painfully into Kit's shoulder. He sounded desperate.
I need to feel it.
Kit had never been a casual hugger, and no one had ever, that he could remember, come to him for comforting. He wasn't a comforting sort of person. He'd always assumed that, and he barely knew Ty. But then, Ty didn't do things for no reason. Even if people whose brains were differently wired couldn't see his reasons immediately. Kit remembered the way Livy rubbed Ty's hands tightly when he was stressed and thought, the pressure is a sensation. The sensation must be grounding, calming. That made sense. So Kit found himself holding Ty harder, until Ty relaxed under the tight grip of his hands, held him more tightly than he'd ever held anyone, held him as if they'd been lost in the sea of the sky, and only holding on to each other could keep them afloat above the wreckage of London. Chapter 20. Evermore. Diana sat in her small room above the weapon shop and flipped through the file Gia had given her. She hadn't been in this room since the end of the Dark War, but it felt comfortable and familiar. The blanket her grandmother had made folded at the foot of the bed, the first blunt wooden daggers her father had given her to practice with on the wall, her mother's shawl across the back of a chair. She wore a pair of bright red satin pajamas she'd found in an old trunk and felt amusingly dressed up. Her amusement faded quickly, though, as she examined the pages inside the cream-colored file. First was Zara's story about how she'd killed Malcolm, which had been signed off on by Samantha and Dane as witnesses. Not that Diana would have believed Samantha or her brother if they'd said the sky was blue. Zara was claiming that the Centaurians had chased Malcolm away the first time he'd attacked, and that the next night she'd fearlessly patrolled the borders of the Institute until she'd found him lurking in the shadows and bested him in a one-on-one sword fight. She claimed his body had then disappeared. Malcolm was hardly a lurk-in-the-shadows type, and from what Diana had seen on the night he'd returned, his magic was still working. He'd never fight Zara with a blade when he could blast her with fire. But none of that was hard evidence that she was lying. Diana frowned, turning the pages, and then sat up straight. There was more here than just the report on Malcolm's death. There were pages and pages about Zara, dozens of reports of her achievements. Altogether like this, it was an impressive package. And yet, as Diana read through, taking careful notes, a pattern started to emerge. Every success of Zara's, every triumph, took place when no one was around to witness it, except for those in her inner circle, Samantha, Dane, or Manuel. Often others would arrive in time to see the empty demon nest or the evidence of a battle, but that was all. There were no reports of Zara ever being wounded or hurt in any battle. Diana thought of the scars she'd gotten through her life as a shadow hunter and frowned more deeply. And more deeply yet when she reached Marisol Garza Solcedo's year-old report. Marisol claimed to have saved a group of mundanes from an attacking Druge demon in Portugal. She was knocked unconscious. When she awoke, she said, Zara's destruction of the Druge was being celebrated. The report had been submitted, along with a signed statement by Zara, Jessica, Samantha, Dane, and Manuel, stating that Marisol was imagining things. Zara, they said, had killed the Druge after a fierce fight. Again, Zara had no wounds. She takes credit for what other people do, Diana thought. Her window rattled. Wind, probably.
I ought to go to bed, she thought. The clock in the guard, new since the Dark War, had rung the early hours of dawn some time ago. But she kept reading, fascinated. Zara would hang back, wait for the battle to be over, and announce victory as her own. With her group backing her up, the Clave accepted her claims at face value. But if it could be proved that she hadn't killed Malcolm, in some way that kept Julian and the others protected, then perhaps the cohort would be disgraced. Certainly the Dearborn's bid to seize the Los Angeles Institute would fail. Her window rattled again. She looked up and saw Gwyn on the other side of the glass. She stood up with a yelp of surprise, sending her papers flying. Get a grip, she told herself. There was no way that the leader of the Wild Hunt was actually outside her window. She blinked and looked again. He was still there, and as she moved toward the window, she saw that he was hovering in the air just below her sill on the back of a massive gray horse. He wore dark brown leather, and his antlered helmet was nowhere to be seen. His expression was grave and curious. He gestured for her to open the window. Diana hesitated, then reached to undo the latch and flung up the sash. She didn't have to let him in, she reasoned. They could just talk through the window. Cool air rushed into her room, and the smell of pine and morning air. His bicolored eyes fixed on her. My lady, he said, I had hoped you would accompany me on a ride. Diana tucked a lock of hair behind her ear. Why? For the pleasure of your company, Gwyn said. He peered at her. I see you are richly attired in silk. Are you expecting another guest? She shook her head, amused. Well, the pajamas were nice. You look beautiful, he said. I am fortunate. She supposed he wasn't lying. He couldn't lie. You couldn't have arranged this meeting in advance, she asked. Sent me a message, maybe? He looked puzzled. He had long eyelashes and a square chin, a pleasant face, a handsome face. Diana often tried not to think about those things, as they only caused trouble, but now she couldn't help it. I only discovered you were here in Idris this dawn, he said. But you're not allowed to be here, she looked nervously up and down empty Flintlock Street. If anyone saw him. He grinned at that. As long as my horse's hooves do not touch Alicante ground, the alarm will not be raised. Still, she felt a bubble of tension in her chest. He was asking her on a date. She couldn't pretend otherwise. And though she wanted to go, the fear, that old fear that walked hand in hand with distrust and grief, held her back. He reached out a hand. Come with me. The sky awaits. She looked at him. He wasn't young, but he didn't look old either. He seemed ageless, as fairies did sometimes. And though he seemed solid and thoughtful in himself, he carried with him the promise of the air and the sky. When else will you ever have a chance to ride a fairy horse? Diana asked herself. When else will you ever fly? You're going to be in so much trouble, she whispered, if they find out you're here. He shrugged, hand outstretched. Then you'd better come quickly, he said. She began to climb out the window. Breakfast was late. Kit managed to snag a few hours of sleep and a shower before wandering into the dining room to find everyone else already sitting down. Well, everyone but Evelyn. Bridget was serving tea, pinched-faced as always. Alec and Magnus each had a child in their lap and introduced them to Kit. Max was the small blue warlock who was spilling brown sauce down the front of Magnus's designer shirt, and Rafe was the brown-eyed child who was tearing his toast to pieces. Kieran was nowhere to be seen, which wasn't unusual at meals. Mark was seated beside Christina, who was quietly drinking coffee. She looked neat and self-contained, as always, despite the red mark on her wrist. She was an interesting mystery, Kit thought, a non-Blackthorn like himself, but inextricably tied to the Blackthorns, nevertheless.
And then there was Livy and Ty. Ty had the buds of his earphones in. Livy looked tired but entirely healthy. Only a slight shadow under Ty's eyes let Kit know he hadn't dreamed the whole of last night. What we found at Blackthorn Hall was an aletheia crystal, Ty was saying as Kit sat down. In the past, the crystals were used by the clave to hold evidence, the evidence of memories. There was a babble of curious voices. Christina's rose above the others. It was an impressive talent of hers to make herself heard without ever shouting. Memories of what? A sort of trial, said Livy. In Idris, with the Inquisitor there. Lots of familiar families. Herondales, Blackthorns, of course, Dearborns. Any Lightwoods? Asked Alec. One or two looked like they might be, Livy frowned.
The Herondales have always been famous for their good looks, said Bridget. But if you ask me, the Lightwoods are the more sexually charismatic of the bunch.
Alec spit out his tea. Magnus seemed to be keeping a straight face, but with an effort. I should examine the memories, Magnus said. See if there's anyone I recognize from that era. If Annabelle is angry at Shadowhunters, said Livy, it seems she has a good reason. Many have good reason to be angry with the Nephilim, said Mark. Malcolm did as well. But those who harmed her are dead, and the descendants blameless. That is the problem with revenge. You wind up destroying the innocent as well as the guilty. But does she know that? Ty frowned. We don't understand her. We don't know what she thinks or feels. He looked anxious, the shadows under his eyes more pronounced. Kit wanted to go across the table and put his arms around Ty the way he had the night before on the roof. He felt intensely protective of the other boy, in a way that was strange and unnerving. He'd cared about people before, mostly his father, but he'd never wanted to protect them. He wanted to kill anyone who would try to hurt Ty. It was a very peculiar feeling. Everyone should watch the scenes in the crystal, Magnus announced. In the meantime, Alec and I have some news.
You're getting married, said Livy, beaming. I love weddings.
Nope, still not getting married right now, said Alec. Kit wondered why not. They were clearly a committed couple, but it was none of his business, really. Evelyn has left us, said Magnus. Somehow he managed to retain his sang-froid despite having a grizzling toddler on his lap. According to Gia, the Institute is temporarily in Alec's charge. They've been trying to lumber me with an institute somewhere for years, said Alec. Gia must be thrilled.
Evelyn left us?
Drew's eyes were huge.
You mean she died?
Magnus started to cough. Of course not. She went to visit your great Aunt Marjorie, actually, in the countryside.
Is this like when the family dog dies and they say he's living in the farm now? Kit asked, curious.
It was Alec's turn to choke. Kit strongly suspected he was laughing and trying not to show it. Not at all, said Magnus. She just decided she'd prefer to miss the excitement. She is with Marjorie, Mark confirmed. I got a fire message about it this morning. She left Bridget, obviously, to help around the house. Kit thought of the way Evelyn had reacted to having a fairy in the Institute. He could only imagine how she felt about two warlocks added to the situation. She'd probably left tire marks behind her when she raced out of the place.
Does that mean we don't have to eat our porridge? Said Tabby, eyeing the grayish stuff with dislike.
Magnus grinned.
In fact,
he snapped his fingers, and a bag from the Primrose Bakery appeared in the middle of the table. It tipped over, spilling muffins, croissants, and iced cakes. There was a shout of happiness, and everyone lunged for the pastries. A small war over the chocolate cookies was won by Ty, who shared them with Livy. Max crawled onto the table, reaching for a muffin. Magnus leaned on his elbows, his cat eyes watchful. And after breakfast, he said, maybe we can go into the library and discuss what we know about the current situation. Everyone nodded. Only Mark looked at him with a slightly narrow gaze. Kit understood. Magnus had gotten rid of Evelyn for them. He'd brought breakfast, he'd put them in a good mood, and now he was going to see what they knew. A straightforward con. Looking at the cheerful faces around the table, for a moment Kit hated his own father, for destroying his ability to ever believe someone might be willing to give something for nothing. Kieran found the whole business of eating dinner and breakfast in a group bizarre and of little interest. Mark had been bringing him plates of food as plain as Bridget could make them, meat and rice and bread, uncooked fruit and vegetables. But Kieran only picked at them. When Mark came into Kieran's room after breakfast, the prince was looking out at the city through his window with a weary loathing. His hair had paled to blue-white, curling like the break of surf at the edge of the water around his ears and temples. "Listen to this," Kieran said. He had a book open on his lap. "The land of fairy, where nobody gets old and godly and grave, where nobody gets old and crafty and wise, where nobody gets old and bitter of tongue." He glanced up at Mark with his luminous eyes. "That's ridiculous." "That's Yeats," said Mark, handing over some raspberries. "He was a very famous mundane poet. He didn't know anything about fairies. Nobody grows bitter of tongue." "Ha!" Kieran swallowed the raspberries and slid off the windowsill. "Where do we journey now?" "I was going to the library," said Mark. "There's a sort of meeting about what we're going to do next." "Then I would like to go to it," said Kieran. Mark's mind raced. Was there any reason Kieran shouldn't come? As far as Magnus and Alec knew, his relationship with Kieran was whatever he said it was. Nor was it any good for Kieran, or for their strained relationship, for a fairy prince to spend all his time in a small room hating seminal Irish poets. "Well," Mark said, "if you're sure." When they walked into the library, Magnus was examining the Alethea crystal, while the others tried to fill him in on what had been going on before he'd arrived. The warlock was lying full length on one of the tables, holding the crystal delicately above him. Christina, Ty, Livy, and Drew were seated around the long library table. Alec was sitting on the floor of the room with three children clustered around him, his own two boys and Tabby, who was delighted to have someone to play with. The 7-year-old was explaining to Max and Rafe how he made towns and cities out of books, showing them how he could make tunnels with books splayed open on their faces for trains to go through. Magnus gestured Mark over to look into the Alethea crystal, which was glowing with an odd light. The sounds in the room around him faded as Mark watched the trial, saw Annabelle beg and protest, saw the Blackthorns doom her to her fate. He felt a chill all over when he finally looked away. It took several moments for the library to come back into focus. To Mark's surprise, Kieran had picked up Max and was holding him in the air, obviously delighted by his blue skin and the buds of his horns. Max stuck his hand into Kieran's wavy hair and pulled. Kieran just laughed. "That's right. It changes color, little Nixie-like warlock," he said. "Look." And his hair went from blue-black to bright blue in an instant. Max giggled. "I didn't know you could do that on purpose," said Mark, who had always thought of Kieran's hair as a reflection of his moods, uncontrollable as the tides. "You don't know a lot of things about me, Mark Blackthorn," Kieran said, setting Max down. Alec and Magnus exchanged a look at that, a sort of look that made Mark feel as if they had reached a silent and agreed-upon consensus about his relationship with Kieran. "So," Magnus said, looking at Kieran with some interest, "you're the son of the Unseelie King?" Kieran had what Mark thought of as his court face on, blank and superior as befitted a prince. "And you're the warlock Magnus Bane?" "Quite," Magnus said. "Although that was an easy guess, since there's one of me and 50 of you." Ty looked puzzled. 50 sons of the Unseelie King," explained Livy. "I think that was a joke." "Not one of my best," said Magnus to Kieran. "I apologize. I'm not a big fan of your father." "My father does not have fans." Kieran leaned against the edge of the table. "His subjects and enemies. And sons. His sons are his enemies," said Kieran without inflection.
Magnus looked at him with a flicker of extra interest.
All right, he said, sitting up. Diana explained some of this to us, but it was more complicated than I thought. Annabelle Blackthorne, who was brought back from the dead by Malcolm, who was sort of dead before but is now very definitely dead, has the Black Volume, and the Seelie Queen wants it?
She does, said Mark. She was very clear about that. And she made you a deal, Alex said from the floor. She always makes a deal.
If we give her the Black Volume, she will use it against the Unseelie King, said Mark, and hesitated.
You can trust Magnus and Alec, Julian had texted earlier. Tell them anything.
She has sworn not to try to use it to harm us. In fact, she has promised to aid us. She made Kieran her messenger. He'll testify in front of the council about the Unseelie King's plans to make war on Alicante. Once the Queen has the Black Volume, she will authorize her Seelie soldiers to fight alongside Shadowhunters against the King. But the Clave will have to end all laws that forbid cooperation with fairies if they want her help.
Which they will, said Magnus. Fighting a war against fairy would be much easier with fairies on your side.
Mark nodded. We are hoping not just to defeat the King, but also to crush the cohort and end the cold peace.
Ah, the cohort, said Magnus, exchanging a look with Alec. We know them well. Horace Dearborn and his daughter Zara.
Horace? Mark was startled.
Sadly, said Magnus, that is his name. Hence his life of evil.
Not that the Dearborns are all of it, said Alec. Plenty of bigots in the Clave, happy together under the umbrella of tossing out the Downworlders and returning the Clave to its former glory.
Glory? Kieran raised an eyebrow.
Do they mean the time of freely killing Downworlders? When our blood ran in the streets and the houses were stuffed with the spoils of their one-sided war?
Yes, said Magnus, though they wouldn't describe it that way.
Heading up the Alliance, we've heard more than a little about the cohort, said Alec. Their pushes to limit warlocks' use of their magic, to centralize blood supply for vampires, so it could be monitored by the Clave. Those have not gone unnoticed.
They must not be allowed to get their hands on the Institute, said Magnus. That could be potentially disastrous.
He sighed and swung his legs over the side of the table.
I understand we must give the Black Volume to the Queen, but I don't like it, especially when it seems doubly important here.
You mean because Annabelle and Malcolm stole it from the Cornwall Institute, said Ty, and then Malcolm stole it again from the Institute in Los Angeles.
The first time they were going to trade it to someone who they thought would protect them from the Clave, said Livy. The second time was with the Unseelie King's help, at least according to Emma and Jules.
And how did they find that out? Asked Magnus.
It was in one of the books they found, said Christina. A diary. It explains why we found an Unseelie court glove at the ruins of Malcolm's house. He must have met with the King, or one of his sons there.
Odd thing to write in a diary, Magnus muttered. Traitorous plans with the Unseelie King afoot today, what ho?
Odder that Malcolm disappeared from the Silent City after the first theft, said Mark, and left Annabelle to take the blame and the punishment.
Why odd, said Livy. He was a terrible person.
But he did love Annabelle, Christina said. Everything he did, the crimes, the murders, all his choices were made for love of her. And when he found out she hadn't become an Iron Sister, but had been murdered by her family, he went to the King of Fairies and asked for her help in bringing her back. Don't you remember?
Mark did remember the story in the old book Tavi had found, which had turned out to be true.
Which explains why Malcolm broke into the Los Angeles Institute to get the book 5 years ago, he said, to bring Annabelle back. But what did Malcolm want it for 200 years ago? Who was he planning to trade it to? Most necromancers couldn't help him with protection. And if it was a warlock, it would have had to have been one stronger than Malcolm himself.
Fade's powerful ally, Ty said, quoting the scene in the crystal.
We don't think it could have been the Unseelie King, Livy said. Both times?
The Unseelie King didn't hate Shadowhunters in 1812, said Magnus. At least, not that much. And Malcolm told Emma that when he went to the Unseelie King after he found out that Annabelle wasn't dead, he thought the king might kill him because he disliked warlocks, said Christina. He wouldn't have a reason to dislike warlocks if he worked with Malcolm before, would he?
Magnus stood up. All right, enough guesswork, he said. We have two duties to carry out today. First, we shouldn't lose sight of the binding spell on Mark and Christina. It's more than just a nuisance. It's a danger to them both. Mark couldn't help glancing at Christina. She was looking down at the table, not at him. He remembered the night before, the warmth of her body beside him in bed, her breath in his ear. He came back to reality with a start, realizing that a discussion of where they were going to get the ingredients for the anti-binding spell was underway.
Given what happened at the Shadow Market yesterday, Magnus added, none of us will be welcome back there again. There is, however, a shop here in London that sells what I need. If I give you the address, can Kit, Ty, and Livy find it?
Livy and Ty clamored their agreement, clearly thrilled to have a mission. Kit was quieter, but the corner of his mouth quirked up. Somehow this youngest Herondale had become so attached to the twins, even Magnus thought of them as a team.
Do you really think it's wise for them to go? Mark interrupted. After what happened yesterday, with them sloping off to the Shadow Market and practically getting Livy killed?
But Mark, Ty protested.
Well, said Magnus, you and Christina should stay inside the Institute. Binding spells are dangerous, and you shouldn't be too far away from each other. Alec is the Institute head. He should stay here. And anyway, the owner of the shop has a certain, let's say, history with me. Better I don't go.
I could go, said Drew in a small voice.
Not by yourself, Drew, said Mark. And these three, he indicated Kit, Ty, and Livy, will just get you in trouble.
I can put a tracking spell on one of them, said Magnus. If they wander off the path they're supposed to follow, it'll make an awful noise mundanes can hear.
Delightful, said Mark, as the twins protested. Kit didn't say anything. He rarely complained.
Mark suspected he was silently plotting to get even instead, possibly with everyone he'd ever met.
Magnus examined a large blue ring on his finger.
We'll do the library research. More about the history of the Black Volume. We don't know who created it, but perhaps who owned it in the past, what it was used for, anything that might point to who Malcolm was working with in 1812.
And remember what Julian and Emma asked us for help with, said Christina, tapping the phone in her pocket. It should only take a few minutes to look it up.
Mark couldn't help staring at her. She was tucking her dark hair behind her ears, and as she did, the sleeve of her sweater slipped down, and he saw the red mark on her wrist. He wanted to go to her, to kiss the mark, to take the pain onto himself. He looked away from her, but not before he caught the edge of a glance from Kieran. Ty and Livy and Kit were getting out of their chairs, excitedly chattering, eager to go on their trip. Drew was sitting with her arms crossed, and Magnus was looking between Christina, Mark, and Kieran thoughtfully, his cat eyes slow and considering.
We shouldn't need to look it up at all, Magnus said. We have a primary source right here.
Kieran, what do you know about catching piskies?
Emma woke late in the morning, surrounded by warmth. Light was breaking through the unshaded windows and making patterns on the walls like dancing waves. Through the window she could see flashes of blue sky and blue water, a holiday view. She yawned, stretched, and went still as she realized why she was so warm. She and Julian had somehow wrapped themselves around each other during the night. Emma froze in horror. Her left arm was thrown across Julian's body, but she couldn't just remove it. He had turned toward her, his own arms curved around her back, securing her. Her cheek brushed the smooth skin of his collarbone. Their legs were tangled together as well, her foot resting on his ankle. She began to slowly detangle herself. Oh, God. If Julian woke up, it would be so awkward, and everything had been going so well. Their conversation on the train, finding the cottage, talking about Annabelle, everything had been comfortable.
She didn't want to lose that. Not now. She edged sideways, slipping her fingers out of his, closer to the edge of the bed, and went over the side with an ungainly tumble. She landed with a thump and a scream that woke Julian, who peered over the side of the bed in confusion. Why are you on the floor?
I've heard rolling out of bed in the morning helps you build up resistance to surprise attacks,
Emma said, lying sprawled on the hardwood floor.
Oh, yeah? He sat up and rubbed his eyes. What does screaming holy crap do?
That part's optional, she said.
She got to her feet with as much dignity as she could muster.
So, she said, what's for breakfast?
He grinned his low-key grin and stretched. She didn't look at where his shirt rode up. There was no reason to sail down Sexy Thoughts River to the Sea of Perversion when it wasn't going to go anywhere.
You hungry?
When am I not hungry? She went over to the table and rooted in her bag for her phone. Several texts from Christina. Most were about how Christina was fine and Emma had nothing to worry about, and she should stop texting because Magnus was going to fix the binding spell. Emma sent her a worry face and scrolled down.
Any word on pisky-catching techniques? Julian asked.
Not yet. Julian didn't say anything. Emma stripped down to her boy's shorts and tank top. She saw Julian glance away from her, though it wasn't anything he'd never seen before. Her clothes covered up more than a bikini. She grabbed up her towel and soap.
I'm going to the shower.
Maybe she was imagining his reaction. He just nodded and went over to the kitchen, firing up the stove.
No pancakes.